Thank you, everyone. We are back in our open line after lunch. We're going to start this afternoon off by doing the bittersweet part of being a member of this distinguished panel, which is recognizing our panelists who've made really great and excellent contributions, some of them from the beginning of PCORI, who will be leaving us. And I'll first start by reading off the list of who those people are, who we've all gotten to know quite well. Alfie Breland-Noble, Martina Gallagher, Elizabeth Jacobs, my partner in many things over the last couple of years, Grant Jones, Patrick Kitzman, Dorian Miller, and Alan Morse. We do have some members who are not with us today. Alfie is not with us, Martina is not with us, and Patrick is not with us. But we do have the wonderful people who are with us, and I'd like to recognize each of them. Alfie, Martina, and we start with Liz. And so I've been working with Liz as a panelist, and last year we became chair and co-chair of PCORI Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel and have really worked closely together, just a great partner. Liz currently is the Associate Vice Chair of Health Service Research in the Department of Medicine and Population Health Science at University of Wisconsin. She's recognized as an expert on the provision of linguistically accessible and culturally competent care and has served on many expert panels. She's published numerous peer-reviewed journal articles and authored 3 book chapters, and she works with other investigators to design culturally specific research. She's a PCORI awardee, as she just shared with us, and she received her MD from the University of California, San Francisco, trained at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and completed a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Fellowship at the University of Chicago. She's been a member of the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel since the beginning, April 2014. Liz, thank you for your service. Grant. Gosh, Grant has been, Grant was chair, co-chair, when I actually joined PCORI Addressing Disparities Panel, and we've all said if we could only do it as well as Grant and Dorian has done it, we would have tried to step into really big shoes. Grant is the founder and executive director of the Center for African American Health. He was a senior program officer for the Pitten Foundation in Denver. His work centered on strengthening neighborhoods and resident leadership development. He spearheaded initiatives to expand the role of faith-based groups in neighborhood improvement and the development of which he's very proud of the Center for African American Health. And he served on the Colorado Blue Ribbon Commission for Healthcare Reform, the Metro Denver Health and Wellness Commission, the Board of Directors of the Colorado Health Foundation, the Partnership of Academicians and Communities for Translation, and the Council of the Colorado Clinical and Translational Science Institute. I think you're hearing two things: someone who works hard, enjoys their work, and continues to give back to the community. Grant shared with me that he was, quote unquote, trying to figure out how he slows down in retirement. I don't see this as a slowdown. I think that you continue to contribute. We've really appreciated your leadership, guidance, and frankly, all that we know you will continue to offer. Thank you very much. And Grant's partner in crime, Dorian Miller. Dorian is the director of the Center for Community Health and Vitality at the University of Chicago Medicine. Dorian directs the Center for Community Health and Vitality. He has the mission to improve population health outcomes for residents on the south side of Chicago through community-engaged research, demonstration, and service models. She was a member of the 2002 IOM committee that produced a guidance for the National Healthcare Disparities Report, and she's brought over 20 years of experience as a community-based primary care provider who's worked with underserved minority populations and has a special interest in behavioral health. received her MD from the University of Chicago, completed a primary care internal medicine residency and general medicine clinical epidemiology fellowship at UCSF. Dorian has served as a member since April 2014 and, as I mentioned, was the former chair from 2014 through May 2016. I actually asked Dorian today, how does she do it all and how do we follow her in learning how to do some of it, not all of it, but really someone who's passionate, takes on more roles, is leading a new funded study, and just continues to do great work. Many of the names that I've mentioned today, as we all know, they may be leaving our panel, but will be working with us going forward in that X role that people continue in. Dorian's definitely one of those people. Dorian, thank you so much. And Alan Morse. Alan is the president and CEO of Lighthouse Guild International. He's adjunct professor of ophthalmology at Columbia in New York. Alan has been the president of Lighthouse and CEO for some time, providing a full spectrum of integrated vision and healthcare services, helping people who are blind or visually impaired, including those with multiple disabilities or chronic medical conditions. He's a trustee in the Healthcare Association of New York, a member of the advisory board of the McPherson Eye Research Institute, University of Wisconsin, and a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Ophthalmology. And Alan has really, for us, raised many issues about disability, about how we look at different populations where vision impacts everything from healthcare to quality of life to the aspects of living independently, and has really brought a lot of that experience and expertise to us on this group, including a wonderful sense of humor. Thank you very much, Alan. And so I do have plaques for our members. These will be distributed at the end of our meeting, but I did want to make sure we had the time to spend on really recognizing everyone. So thank you, everyone who continues to be part of our panel. But as I said, you don't really leave. You just get a nice plaque, and we continue to go to you as a resource. Thank you.
I just want to remark that it seems like so much longer than 3 years because we've done so much, but it's been such a pleasure working with everyone and learning from all of you. So I'm grateful to PCORI for this opportunity and for all of you. Parag, do you want to come up? We're going to right now have a presentation from Parag Agarwal, who's a senior program officer for healthcare delivery and disparities research, and he's going to do an update on the glaucoma topic brief. And then we're going to have time for discussion.
Great, thank you. And I think it's very fitting that Alan was the last recognition on this. This is one of his bread and butter topics on here. Do you mind if I click? Thank you. All right, so I am going to bring back the topic of glaucoma and give everybody an update and kind of talk to the panel about next steps, where we stand within here. So, real quick history on this topic. So the original topic that we had commissioned the topic brief for last year was the comparative effectiveness of eye drops versus laser trabeculoplasty to reduce excess morbidity from glaucoma in Black and Hispanic individuals. So this was ranked highly by this panel as a topic. And so we commissioned the topic brief back at the fall of last year, and two members of this panel, Alan Morrison and Tung Nguyen, reviewed that topic brief, and then we discussed it in our October meeting within here. And the recommendation was to move forward with this topic. So in terms of what that means when we move forward with it, was our next step was to present this topic to our Science Oversight Committee, which we did at the end of last year. And based on that presentation, there were several questions that came up, questions, concerns, some broad, some more specific around this particular topic and this, you know, very narrow topic that we had identified to focus on. So our addressing disparities staff took it upon ourselves to address some of those questions, do a lot of research and really dig down into these questions. And we also talked with a few experts in the field to help us address some of these. And so based on that, So here are some of the questions from the Science Oversight Committee. So some of the broad questions that they asked were around the nature of the disease and its progression, and you know, really trying to understand if it is too slow moving to really capture outcomes in a 3 to 5 year study, which is the length of PCORI studies. You know, most of the max ones being 5 years. So can you actually capture outcomes within that time frame? Some of the other questions were, what is causing the outcome of blindness? Is it screening? Is it late diagnosis, variability in disease progression, adherence, et cetera? And have any gaps in knowledge been called out within the literature? And then some of the specific questions they asked were specifically, are screening practices in place to look for glaucoma? And this is, you know, predominantly open-angle glaucoma that we're talking about here. What are the statistics among the Asian American population, since we had called out African Americans and Hispanics, but not Asian Americans? And what are some of the outcomes for the eye drops versus the laser surgery? And so we did a lot of research, and I really, you know, tip my hat to Julie Anderson, who really dug down deep into these questions and did a lot of research to come up with some answers. But it really boiled down to begging the question, you know, are eye drops versus laser surgery really the right comparators to look for within this this group of individuals? And so just a little bit more background information as we kind of took that question and moved forward with it. And so in terms of, you know, the outcomes that we'll be looking for, you know, it's really progressive vision loss that reduces quality of life, which could lead to a definition of legal blindness if left untreated. And so those are kind of, you know, quality of life and legal blindness, the outcomes to really hone in on. And in terms of, you know, the prevalence among different populations, so we do see, you know, the African American and somewhat to some extent the Hispanic population with disparities, and we also saw a slight disparity with the Asian American population. But interestingly enough, when we dug down a little deeper into the Asian American population, we noticed that there were more discrepancies within subpopulations within there. So within this, you know, so this is broader Asian definition, because it includes the Indian subcontinent within here. But you saw the largest disparities within the Japanese population and then the Indian and Pakistani populations within there as well. So there is this notion that there is a group there that should be considered with any kind of topic here to look for. And then the other thing, you know, from a background perspective was that medicated eye drops and laser surgery, both of them, are effective in slowing the progression of vision loss and improving quality of life for patients with open-angle glaucoma. And then the other thing we did when we did our review was come up with barriers when we're looking at, you know, the issues with glaucoma. And we talk a lot about, you know, what are the barriers, especially for disparity populations, and how, you know, if you want to have a good research project, how do you overcome those barriers? So where were the areas to look for? And this, you know, most of this kind of just spreads the care continuum within there, but the four areas that we identified are listed here. And so the first gap that's out there is looking at screening and diagnosis. So it's really getting these individuals to the clinic to actually get an eye exam, which there's a disparity there and a gap of actually getting them within there to be screened and then diagnosed with glaucoma, particularly considering with open-angle glaucoma, it's not one of those things where you slowly see less and less, since it's an angular thing. It's your field of vision which changes, and it's something that many people aren't necessarily aware of until it's too late or until it really has progressed within there. So getting them in there early to get screened and diagnosed within there. The second aspect was treatment, so getting them to actually agree on moving forward with the treatment. Again, if in early stages of open-angle glaucoma, if you don't feel like your quality of life is affected that much, you may say, my day-to-day is not really changing, so why should I bother going for this laser surgery or start taking eye drops within there? So actually getting them to get onto a treatment option. The third point was medication adherence and or treatment follow-up. So the adherence aspect is more around the eye drops. So you have to take these eye drops every day, and no one likes doing that. I mean, I had laser surgery for corrective vision 9 years ago, and I still suffer from dry eyes, and I'm supposed to take eye drops every day, but it doesn't affect my quality of life as much as it could. So I am of that mindset of, not that bad, so I'm not gonna do the eye drops. Of course, for me, it's not as bad as not taking these eye drops and leading to glaucoma, but it's that mindset that we know is an issue with these populations. And then treatment follow-up, which is for both eye drops and laser surgery. So going into your follow-ups, 3, 6, 9 months into it, to ensure that the treatments are being successful and we're kind of looking forward, and there are no issues within there in getting people to do that. So those are kind of the ones on the care continuum. The fourth aspect that was pointed out was this idea of trust and communication, as is very common amongst a lot of minority populations, disparity populations, is the communication issues between non-minority physicians and a minority patient. And having that proper communication, making sure you know your options, having a trust in the physician that they are aware of your issue and can treat it adequately based on your needs and desires, and then really pushing in there. So those were kind of the four barriers that we identified. That we said if we wanted to push forward, we would look for studies to overcome these barriers and address it within this population. So based on all of that research and understanding, will be, our kind of recommendations and next steps. And the recommendations from an outcome perspective that we came up with would be that the outcome should really be to slow down the progression of vision loss and improve patient quality of life. So I think we understand that this is a slow progressing disease, and so you're not going to be able to tell within a 3 to 5 year study if you have completely halted and you're not going to experience vision loss. But you want to slow down the progression, and you can monitor that from looking at your angle vision for periphery vision, and to improve patient quality of life, right? So where does it start to get to the point where it affects their quality of life, and how to improve that so that they can do their day-to-day functions that are most important to them? And then so the topic should really focus on addressing the barriers that I just mentioned that prevent the progression of glaucoma for disparity populations. And some examples of comparative interventions, could explore best options to, as we said, improve access to initial eye exams and screening, enhance physician-patient communication, prescription or recommendation of best treatment options, and then adherence to appropriate medication. So we're here today to kind of bring this back to the ADAP and get some additional insights and thoughts around these. Basically, does this make sense from a progression of glaucoma? Does it make sense to take a step back from our narrowly focused eye drops versus laser surgery and look at some of the larger issues that reside for these patients who are experiencing a progression of loss of vision? And is there one area to focus on that's better as it relates to the care continuum or communication strategies? Talking about the population to pursue and within there. Based on that input, our goal would be to bring this back to the SOC to address some of their questions and concerns in the way we did it with your input, and then look towards the next steps if this should be a refined comparative effectiveness question for a target funding announcement or a priority area within there. So with that, I want to open it up for discussion. And just kind of get, initial gut reactions or thoughts and topics and areas.
Thank you, Parag. Eleanor, you had your...
Yes. So I have to start, Eleanor Schoenfeld. I have to start by saying I feel like I'm in a little bit of deja vu. And I've done, our department has been involved in vision research. It's been 25 years. And some of what we had done was looked at adherence with drops. And so there's a lot out there, and Alan could answer more in terms of what's current, but I feel like it needs to be taken beyond the same old, which is a lot of what's up there right now. The communications between a non-minority clinician and a minority patient. That's some of the research I've done, and it goes across the board. It doesn't matter what disease. So my concern with the list that's up there is it's in a sense getting away from what the original question was, that brought this to the table. And I would like to see more of it focused on answering the question whether there is a better treatment or similar treatment that will create more adherence, because that's part of it, not just what's up there now.
Thank you. Dorian?
So, Dorian Miller, so I appreciate the additional data on Asian Americans, and specifically looking at Asian American subgroups in terms of thinking about this as a disparity, because I think that's a very important question. I also think that, and this is in light of our prior discussion around improving health systems and health disparities, that the idea of diagnosis and treatment was actually a gap in both areas. And so there may be some opportunity for funding in terms of the access to initial eye exams and screening in order to have at least one project to help to fill that gap. The issue of physician and patient communication may be a subset of the issue that Eleanor just raised around what is the recommendation around best treatment options, in that does physician-patient communication, whether there be discordance between the physician versus the patient in terms of background, makes a difference in terms of uptake, in terms of recommendations. And so I would want to think of that as being incorporated rather than as a standalone in terms of treatment. Glad to see this back again.
Thank you, Dorian. Cincy.
Cincy Hernandez-Cancio. I was going to, first of all, say what Dorian just said, that it's really great to see the subpopulations, and I think that's a direction that we should all be considering, not just for API, but also for Latinos. So that's very compelling to see those numbers, right, because we know how the average can just completely obscure the realities in different populations. I also feel like I'm in a weird time loop, because from what I remember, you know, I remember hearing Romana talk to us about how what PCORI needed was more very specific, compare this to this, and preferably not just usual standard of care questions to be raised. And so we worked a lot to find these very specific, you know, two things to compare. And now I feel like that's just taking us back to more generalities. So I'm not understanding, you know, the internal kind of piece, PCORI thought process in this, because I feel like we're going backwards.
Yeah, absolutely. No. That's a perfectly legitimate question, right? And you're absolutely right that the ultimate goal, if we come up with a good comparator question, is to come up with something very specific that people can then target against. So, yes, the panel did a lot of work, and especially with Tung and Alan's review of the topic brief around eye drops versus laser surgery within there. And that's the direction we would like to move into, which is with the direction I would like to eventually end up here if we come up with another set of comparators. I think the issue came up with saying these are two good things to compare, but will comparing these two things address the gaps and give you the answers that you're looking for when you look at these disparity gaps? And I think between the Science Oversight Committee and between talking with a few other experts in there, the answer was pretty much no, because they're two effective models that the issue is not which one should I do. There are other issues which are more important than which one should I partake in.
So can I ask a follow-up question on that? So where in that process did you see the biggest gap? Like where do people fall off the path of getting diagnosed, treated, et cetera?
Yeah. So I think it depends on which one you look at within here, right? So these are the gaps that came out of there, right? And I agree, it's kind of going back to you know, to Eleanor's point, it is kind of deja vu for a lot of people when they think about studying this field, because this is not new. This is known that these are still the gaps, and this is where we started with originally. I just think the step that we took forward in identifying those two comparators took us down a path that ended up not being the right path to go down. So now let's back up on that roadmap. we present these and then find out the right path. So there are gaps in screening and diagnosis among these populations. There are gaps in initiating treatment, and there are gaps in adhering to the medications. I mean, the medication adherence gap is not just a minority issue. It's just, you know, everybody as well, but there obviously are minority issues or, you know, disparity issues within there, and then obviously the trust in communication. So it is, we have taken a step back to a point where if you're, you know, on a four-step roadmap, we're probably back to step two and a half to figure out what three is, that comparative question that really will get at the answers, and then moving forward with that.
Thank you. Alan?
Well, first, kudos to Prague and his team. They did a terrific job of putting this together. And when we spoke about a week and a half ago, remarkable progress in a week and a half. So I don't know how you do it. Sensi's question is a good one, and the other question about where, you know, comparing two things, I thought that's what we were. As we talked and as it unfolded, we have two good treatments, and the challenge is to get patients into treatment, and either treatment will work. I was intrigued by the opportunity to remove adherence as a barrier, which is what you get with laser. Laser usually is good for 3.5 to 5 years. You go for your follow-up exams, and if you need it more often, they can do it. You can do it for at least two and usually at least three times. So if they're good for 5 years each, you delay the progression for maybe 15 years. If it's picked up on diagnosis at 45 or 50 and you've delayed progression for 15 years, you've done a remarkable job of helping that person's quality of life up to that point, and from there forward, there's no indication that the progression is going to be more rapid, and then you can go on drops when you're done with laser. So I thought that, and your chair at Columbia and I had a lengthy discussion about this. We actually shared a patient who I referred to Joel, and I said, what did Joel recommend? He said, laser, no hesitation, laser, because it takes the adherence element out of it. So from my perspective, that's a really big deal. The problem with adherence with drops, and when Prague and I spoke about this, he told me about his refractive surgery and how difficult it is to take drops, and spoke with someone else earlier who's also taking drops for something else. They said, how much do you spill? Yeah, 3, 4, 5 drops. That means in the average medication bottle, you're only going to have enough for 20 or 22 or 23 days. The pharmacy won't refill. So we don't know enough about what happens in those 5 or 7 days, because probably your glaucoma is progressing, then you go back on med 22 or 23 days, it progresses again, and this keeps repeating, so you have micro progression of glaucoma, again, to me, leading towards preference for laser. All of these other things, and I have a colleague at Michigan who is looking at communication issues in ophthalmology in general and has identified racial disparities. The residency program director at Harvard is doing a lot of work now on how do we teach residents to talk with patients, and the model we're using for that is pediatric oncology, because no one does it better than they do in terms of little kids and bad news. So we're doing that. So in communication, I think there are things going on. I think adherence, no one has solved, and half the patients who get prescription drops will be off it within 6 months, which is an awful result. Means they're going to lose vision as a result of something that's treatable, again, leads me back to laser. So I'm not an ophthalmologist, but I keep seeing laser as being the result, and no one I talk to who is an ophthalmologist says I'm wrong. So if it's going to improve the outcome in a minority community, if it's a one shot and out for 5 years or 4 years, it seems to me to have the best chance, but no one has done that research. So no one has gathered that data, which is why I framed the issue the way I did initially.
Thank you, Alan. No, Deirdre's next. And then me.
Sorry. Deirdre Cruz. So I can, I guess my question, and maybe I think I was getting some clarification on this, but if is your perception, Alan, that the problem is more at the level of detection or of disease, or is it keeping minority or disadvantaged patients engaged in care over time and such that they are receiving the eye drops and so forth? And do we know that? And I guess that was maybe that kind of was a question that was raised earlier.
Real quickly, if you know the answer. Yeah. Yeah. Quickly, please.
So the answer to your question is yes. The initial problem is you can't treat patients who don't show up for treatment. So if none of us, how many people in this room have had a dilated eye exam in the last 2 years? Pretty good. Wow. Oh, all right.
Run crowd. Run
okay.
Crowd.
Yeah. Good for you. Good for you. Right? But generally, I ask that question. Yes, picking them up for treatment is really important. Once you pick them up, so I diagnose, you're diagnosed as having glaucoma, then what? You have to show up for treatment, or you have to agree to treatment. You have to agree to refill your drops every month, or you have to go for the one laser. Laser kind of scares people a little bit because they're not sure what it is. So all those communication issues, the way that PROG has broken this up is really quite good because all of those things, they all interplay.
So, and we don't
think
know.
We have enough research on each element.
Yeah. Sorry. I guess my question was, we don't know. We at this point, and I think I'm understanding, we don't know which one is a bigger barrier. My question was, do we know? Is the bigger issue that we're just not detecting all the people that have it, or that they are not staying engaged in following up in care?
Both.
It's both. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. I'm just going to say something. Two things that are. Really quickly, one is that an important place where you could do an intervention and study it is how do you get primary care physicians or people in other specialties. We were talking about not only primary care physicians, but there are so many specialties who have contact with patients at risk for glaucoma, and how do we get them to ask, do you have a family history, what's going on, let's get you screened. That's one thing. The second thing I would say is I understand that you feel that laser would be an excellent treatment for minority patients, but I have patients who are extremely distrustful, and you say something like, I'm going to shoot a laser in your eye, and they're like, no way, that's experimental. I'm not doing that thing. So I think that that's also a really important question for this particular group in addressing disparities is what might seem make the most sense to you is not patient-centered, and it doesn't make sense to these populations. So I think that's I think is a really important question. And then we're going to go on to Grant.
Yes, Grant Jones. I remember we had this conversation, some part of what we had in this conversation previously, and it's striking to me that the prevalence among African Americans is nearly twice any other ethnic group. But I live in a community that's high altitude, in fact, a mile high in Denver. So the other thing in terms of prevalence and targeting that I'm curious about is, to what extent does the high altitude reflect on higher risk of glaucoma, or are there other geographic issues like that that would make it a nuance?
Okay. Umbreen, you had a question?
Yeah. I'm Maureen Nahal. Thank you for a great presentation. So from a payer perspective, in order to be able to, for a payer to say, I will sign off on this laser surgery, oftentimes, if they're two equally perceived to be equally effective treatments, it may be that the payer, I don't know this for sure, but the way payers think, the payer may say, you should do the drops, and only after you fail would you be eligible for a laser. I'm not saying I know this for a fact, but that's an example of how payers may think. But in that process, though, if there's lack of adherence, then there's progression of eye disease. So if we want to improve access from the payment mechanism, we may need that data of showing that one, in real-life use, not in perfect use, but in real-life use, if there's lack of adherence to drops, we may need that data. And it would also drive clinician decision-making and help, you know, if there's this perception that laser may be better, but there's no data, then that patient might reply back, well, that's experimental. But if you do have the results, then you can counter with, we studied it in all populations, and we do know this will preserve your vision. So then it could become patient-centered, whereas right now we're relying more on provider perceptions. And then it also will feed into guidelines that are developed.
Thank you, Amreen. Cheryl?
So in trying to frame questions, I think number one, and we've said there are two that are important. So number one, you know, when we talk about screening, the use of telehealth for screening and allowing other physician specialties is actually a real question that needs to be answered. So as we build on what Alan's attempting to raise to the forefront, because that hasn't been looked at, and, you know, I just want to second Eleanor's comment. There's been a lot of work done in this area, but that hasn't been looked at. While we were sitting here, I pulled it up. There are about four or five really good telehealth glaucoma screening programs that have been done in primary care and other settings that have led to treatment. So I think figuring out for these communities are those options, that's a good question to ask. But I think the question of adherence, you know, we go around that a lot. You know, this reminds me of bariatric surgery versus obesity management counseling. And I do think there's something here about 5 years of treatment, of not getting treatment full 30 days each time with drops, progression of disease, and so the comparative effectiveness of quality of life, of cost to patient, and not just the monetary cost, and does it equal out in the end? There's something there for two gold standard treatments, and I do think we need to look at it through that lens as well. Not sure that that's how it was kind of looked at as we presented it.
Thank you, Cheryl. We have Tung, Barbara, and Eleanor, and then we're going to end this discussion.
Thank you. I was actually thought my work here was done when Parag presented disaggregated Asian data. I was going to say anything, but it's like, thank you, Parag. but I do have something to say, Cheryl would say. He talks too much, but that's all right. But I looked at the USPSTF recommendation. They actually cited 2AHRQ review only about 4 years ago. And the screening recommendation is, of course, it's an I, because there's no evidence that screening leads to better outcome, partly because we have issues with treatment. And actually, if you read between the line of those two assessments, the screening one says doesn't seem to work, mostly dependent on treatment, and the treatment says treatments are good, but we don't know the difference between the two of them. I can't imagine better support for a comparative effectiveness study. I mean, if you can show that one of them is superior to the other, you may be able to show by implementing it that screening actually works. So the point here isn't that we shouldn't do more screening. The point here is that we need to do better treatment so that we can show what we all believe is that better screening is better. And so I think the comparative effectiveness study will actually address 2 and 3 also, and you can study 4 within this whole conversation about adherence and cost and quality of life. So if you design the RFA right, you can actually answer a lot of these questions.
Thank you. Barbara.
I'm concerned because I know I dealt a lot with my dad had glaucoma and macular degeneration, and his eye doctor, they were the same culture, and he would give him a list of things to go home and look up on the internet. My father was 94. He didn't know what the internet was, and he couldn't see. And I just, you know, I'm just wondering if, you know, how much of communication. My experience was just it was like 150% communication, because he wanted to do all this laser stuff, and he, you know, go look up this laser procedure, go look up that laser procedure, and of course, you know, he called me and told me to look it up, and I don't know anything about that stuff. You know, if it was diabetes, I could tell him lots of information. But I'm just wondering how much of this is communication in general. I don't know how ophthalmologists are, you know, nothing personal, how they're, you know, trained to deal with these things in general, because they're talking about highly technological stuff. And I could understand people being suspicious. I mean, if you told me you were going to put a laser in my eye, I don't know that I'd want, you know, that to me is like Frankenstein stuff. How are you dealing with older people who don't understand any technology? So I really wonder. These are the same things, and I'm wondering if we need to look at some of the same things that may be newer angles of those same things because of the changes in technology.
Thank you. And Eleanor, last word.
So I want to come back to something that Alan said, because it's really, really important. And that is that even after diagnosis, patients either do not refill their meds on time, the meds are not efficiently, the dispensers are not efficient, so there's gaps. So those gaps could even be extended because now they've got 5 days or 10 days because they squirted 4 drops instead of one, and now they're waiting to get their prescription filled and then until they go to fill it. So there could be months between refills. And then after a while, it's not the same price. And so there are so many barriers to using drops. I mean, the literature is there that say drops work. But drops only work if they're 100%. So, you know, we have to keep our eye on that and to see what else can be done to help people. And that's something, you know, that gets lost sometimes in the translation. And that's why it's important to address this topic and figure out, and I'd like to put my pitch in for because telehealth would help. Many of the underserved communities do not have specialists. You can't get in to see a specialist. You know, the wait time might be really long. And so even if a primary care physician says it's time for your exam, it could be 6 months before you get an exam. And then you have to travel because they're only outside of your community. You know, because it's not just an ophthalmologist, now you're going to a glaucoma specialist and now you're traveling more. So that's something that should be thought about and maybe focused on and targeted. So even if you're not talking about the comparative effectiveness of drops versus surgery, but you're looking at new ways to get people into the system as well.
Thank you, Eleanor. So I was wrong. Prague wants to say something, but did you have a last comment?
Grant Jones again. I just want to quickly say something. I didn't want to leave the impression that my comment about the Mile High situation in Denver was maybe leaning toward being amusing about marijuana progressiveness in Denver. I may not understand the cause and effect, but I do know that at a Mile High that UVA and UVB rays are much more intense, much more damaging, much more leads much more toward cataract development and such as that. So while I may not understand it, I think it would be worth noting that if there's going to be some targeting, given that I'm an African American living at a Mile High, I'm wondering other African Americans at double high risk because they're a Mile High with these greater intensities of UVA, UVB rays. And so I just want to make sure that's not ignored.
Thank you, Grant. I'm sorry. That was my fault as a moderator of the discussion. I should have given you more time. I appreciate you coming back in. Parag.
Great. Thanks. This is Parag. So Grant, to your point, yes, we'll look to see if we can find any data or see if anything. And I think it's a very important point, not just altitude, but other geographical locations, and if that's something within there. Just to kind of follow up on Eleanor and Alan's comments and questions and kind of the general discussion that we've had here as we can kind of move forward with this. I think, Eleanor, I think you're spot on in that the aspects that we've outlined here are important in the context of the comparators, right? I think where the SOC and other people got hung up on was the fact that, you know, the question begged to answer the comparing these two interventions and which one is better, right? Which it probably is not the right question, but some variation of that is probably the right question, right? And I think the one of the main reasons for that was going back to one of my initial comments, which was around timing, right? And so, you know, laser surgery is a 5-year thing. Eye drops are supposed to be all the time, and you're supposed to go in for 6-month checkups, et cetera. Most of our studies, maximum, you kind of see 18-month follow-ups, maybe 2-year follow-ups if you can hurry up and do recruitment and everything in time for a large 5-year study. And with those short follow-up times of the progression of this disease, if you're comparing eye drops versus laser surgery, are you going to be able to see a big enough difference to make that a worthwhile study? And so maybe it's, you know, again, stepping back from saying we're not going to compare the effectiveness of eye drops versus laser surgery, but some of the auxiliary outcomes that you're looking for or some of the auxiliary causes that will eventually make you make the decision of whether you want to do eye drops or laser surgery, but that not be the focus of the question, so I think.
Yeah,
great. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. That was very helpful.
And also, thank you, Tung and Alan, for the work that you guys put into that. We're going to move on to our next session, and we'll have Myra come up. She's the Program Officer for Healthcare Delivery and Disparities Research, and she'll be giving us an overview of our broad portfolio. So the way we're doing this, Myra has her presentation. We've actually left ample time for discussion, about 45 minutes. So hopefully everyone will feel as if they get to have their questions answered as well. With that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you. And I want to be sensitive that we are in the after lunch segment of our meeting. So if anybody would like to stand up for a minute before I start, please take the opportunity. We can just pause for a minute if anybody needs to stretch or anything. Wow. Okay. So as I was introduced, my name is Myra Greaser. I'm a program officer here in the Addressing Disparities portion of our Healthcare Delivery and Disparities Research Program. And I'm going to present an overview of the broad portfolio that we have. And we've talked about this before, but just to generally orient you again, the broad portfolio is a group of investigator-initiated topics. The projects have a three-year duration and $1.5 million in direct costs. With indirects, they're about $2 million projects each. So we have funded 58 of these projects for a $107 million investment so far. So with 58 projects, there are a number of ways to categorize them, and Steve has already gone through a lot of that work this morning. I'm just going to touch on it briefly. We can obviously group them by priority populations. We have, by addressing disparities priority populations, we have projects in each of these categories that are listed here. We also have projects on various conditions. I've listed some of the conditions that we have the most projects in. Mental health and cardiovascular health would be sort of the top of the list in terms of the numbers of projects. And of course, we can, you know, within these, they can be subdivided as well. We have, for example, four projects on diabetes that, you know, would be a nice cluster of projects as well. And there are other examples. And we also have a broad range of projects in a range of intervention settings. Again, we spoke about this earlier, interventions that take place in the home, in the schools, in communities, in primary care settings, in hospital settings, and there are others as well. These are sort of just the bigger categories. And then finally, we also have a range of intervention strategies that these projects target. And these strategies are from the driver model, which Steve went over earlier. These are the tertiary drivers here. We have interventions that are self-management in nature. We have community health worker interventions. We have interventions that do cultural or language tailoring, decision support, team-based care, family caregiver involvement, and social support. So that's, again, just a little bit of context here for this portfolio. So we have, we wanted to let you know a little bit about the four most recent projects we funded, and Steve again went over these briefly. They were announced last year. I'll just quickly say we're really excited about these four. The first one is on perinatal depression. As you know, there's high priority evidence gaps in this area. And this will be, they will be comparing two brief depression intervention strategies in primary care settings to improve outcomes among low-income minority pregnant and postpartum women, primarily focused on African American and Latino women. We also have a childhood obesity study that's in the Dan River region, as Steve mentioned, comparing two family-based childhood obesity treatment programs in this very rural area of Virginia and North Carolina. And we're excited about this, again, because it brings in the family support piece, too. And they will be enrolling parent-child dyads in this case. The third one I'll just highlight a little bit. This is from a team that has an existing PCORI project on with this U.S. Pacific Islander population. It's specifically the U.S. Marshallese population, and they have quite significant disparities in diabetes. And this particular team has really shown a lot. They have a very strong community engagement model and have done some really good work with this community and are building on those structures and relationships that they've that they've had with that initial project. And then finally, we're excited about the last project because we don't have anything else like this in the portfolio. This is looking at, and also it's in Alaska. This is looking at a disparity that Alaskan Natives experience a very high burden of treatable hearing loss compared with the general U.S. population. It's about 31% versus 2% in the general population. And most Alaskan villages where this research will be conducted are not connected by roads to other villages, making access to a specialist very difficult. So they will be comparing two school-based screening and referral processes, a general primary care referral versus an immediate telemedicine consult. And the telemedicine piece is something that has been used it's been used for many years in other areas in Alaska, but not this is the first time that they have utilized it into the school hearing screening process. So, and then also with the broads, we are currently in the process of naming our slate for the next funding cycle, which will be announced by the board in the late summer. And then the cycle after that, the applications are due today. So we're keeping ourselves quite busy with kind of the flow of the applications and the project management. So next, I would like to talk about project completion. Here we have our project end dates. This is, again, just for the broad portfolio. We did terminate two projects, so the sample here is 56 projects that we expect to be completed. And you'll notice that we have a really large number of projects that will be completed in 2017 and into 2018. And again, this is reflective of some of the earlier days when PCORI was funding, our funding cycles were closer together. There was a lot of investment in the broad portfolio, and some of that has shifted a little bit now that we're investing some more in targeted and pragmatic studies. So I think that the take-home point of this slide is that we really have a lot of projects ending soon, and we are starting to think about how to communicate them. And I just wanted to briefly show this slide. Again, this breaks down our projects according to the target populations that we have in our program. You can see the green are the projects that have finished. And so we're starting to make inroads in many of those priority populations in terms of having results. So just a reminder, when projects are completed at PCORI, all awardees must submit a final research report. This is required by PCORI's authorizing legislation, and it's an overview of the findings and the methodology of the study. This undergoes a peer review process, which takes about 4 to 6 months, and then once the final version is agreed upon by the awardee and by PCORI, eventually we will post it on our PCORI website. And then also awardees are writing publications at the same time that this is happening, and they're working with their stakeholders to disseminate their findings as well. We also have a limited competition dissemination and implementation funding stream that awardees may apply for once they have submitted that final research report. And again, just within our AD portion of the broad portfolio, we have 15 projects that are finished, and then 10 of those have submitted their draft final research report. The others we're expecting them very soon. And as the months go by, we will add to that project completion total quite significantly. So I wanted to, at this point, we'll come back to these questions, but I wanted to get them out here, these questions that we have for this panel, to start thinking about as I continue my presentation. How can PCORI communicate the results of our funded projects? We have clusters of projects by topic area, by target population, by intervention setting. We have other ways to kind of slice and dice things. We also have individual projects that may have compelling results that could be communicated individually. Who should be targeted, and health systems, payers, providers, families, patients? I mean, this is a very broad question at this point. But we want to keep our focus on what's in our mission statement, which is how do we start applying these results to actual reduction of disparities in health and healthcare, and kind of keep that in mind. Okay. So next I'm going to present some project results, and this is, we've heard from this group that you're very interested in hearing results of research that we funded. So that's kind of where this is coming from. I will be doing a fairly high-level presentation here. It was great to hear from Dr. Carden earlier, a more in-depth look at her project, and I think that was very very interesting and valuable to go through. This will be more of a high-level presentation. So the first projects I'd like to talk about are, we have two projects here that are on serious mental illness and peer navigation. So, and this maybe a little bit gets at what came up earlier in the discussion, the intersectionality of our populations. In these studies, Latinos with serious mental illness, so they're racial ethnic minorities and also have a disability. We have two projects that were funded, and both have now completed. One is the PI is John Brecky of University of Southern California. The other is Patrick Corrigan of Illinois Institute of Technology, and they were looking at the question of how to engage individuals with serious mental illness in their health care, because there is a great disparity that these individuals have high rates of comorbidities that are often undiagnosed, untreated, or undertreated, which then leads to a shortened lifespan compared with the general population. And there is a call, a need based on, from systematic reviews, a need for interventions for that particularly target racial and ethnic minority individuals with serious mental illness. So the research question for both of these studies was, can peer navigation improve access to primary care and other outcomes for individuals with serious mental illness? They were both RCTs. They were both on the small side, 100 participants to about 120. And the participants were predominantly Latino from the Brecky study and exclusively Latino from the Corrigan study. And both of them were looking at they were looking at peer navigation within an integrated services of a behavioral healthcare organization. So they found that compared with the usual care group, the group receiving peer navigation had more positive health outcomes, including better access and use of primary care, better quality relationship between the primary care physician and the patient, increased confidence, increased empowerment, and better quality of life. So these studies together point, although they both are small, they point to that there's evidence that point to the benefits of peer navigators in these populations, in engaging folks who maybe are more difficult to engage in healthcare, and also improve quality of life and other patient-centered outcomes. So now I'm jumping to another project. This one was recently completed. the PI is Ron Myers of Thomas Jefferson University, and they are, he and his team are looking at increasing colorectal cancer screening among Hispanic primary care patients. We know that the screening adherence for colorectal cancer is significantly lower in Hispanics than in non-Hispanic whites. And there has been a lot of work about done on a mailed intervention, which has two options for CRC screening, which is one is a stool blood test kit, and the other would be a colonoscopy, where a choice is provided, and these are mailed to patients, and that is an established way to promote CRC screening. This study is looking at a new method to maximize adherence in targeting, in particular, Hispanic patients. So their question is, can a telephone-based decision support and navigation intervention boost CRC screening rates in Hispanics? And the comparators were this mailed kit with decision support and navigation versus a mailed kit only. And the decision support and navigation was a pretty simple one phone call where the patient navigator would talk through the issues with the patient, give them some decision counseling support, and then after a plan was made, they would contact the health system to help with scheduling the appointment. So this was a multi-level intervention at the patient and at the provider level. So they had 400 patients, and their primary outcome was screening adherence within 12 months. This study is just finishing, and so we have 6 months data here, but they did find a substantial increase in colorectal cancer screening at 6 months. And we are looking forward to hearing more from this team, and we're excited about the findings with this. And then finally, I'm going to present some results from our study, the quality study. The PI is Adil Haider from Brigham and Women's University, or Brigham and Women's Hospital. So there have been multiple recommendations for healthcare settings to collect sexual orientation information, but there are no clear guidelines or best practices currently, and many providers question whether patients want to disclose this information. So PCORI funded this project about 3 years ago, and the overall objective was to develop and test approaches for routinely collecting both sexual orientation and also gender identity information in an ED setting. The results that I'm presenting here are just from the phase one piece of the project, which there was a comment about the need for more formative or exploratory projects, and I think this might be an example of one where the evidence base is lacking, and so we had this first phase, or they proposed this phase one research. So in this phase one, they did in-depth interviews. They also did, and then based on that, they conducted a national survey with just over 1,500 patients and over 420, almost 430 providers. And both samples were kind of divided equally between, in the patients, it was equal division between LGBTQ and straight, and providers, it was nurses and doctors. And the findings in this were very interesting. So almost 78% of providers thought that patients would refuse to disclose sexual orientation, while on the other hand, only 10% of patients reported that they would refuse to disclose sexual orientation. This is a big discrepancy. And it's very interesting. I think some of their qualitative results maybe point to explanations for this. The providers in the interviews were very concerned about making people feel uncomfortable with those questions. But then the patients who were interviewed also said that it is relevant to the ED visit, and that there was a pretty clear call that that they should be asked, but you need to ask everyone routinely, because doing so creates a sense of normalcy and acceptance. So that's what they heard loud and clear from these results. And then the last bullet there, both groups did report, they favored nonverbal self-reporting versus verbal self-reporting. And I'll just say a bit about their overall study. That is exactly what they are testing. They're testing two approaches. One would be the verbal self-reporting to a nurse versus the second method is nonverbal self-reporting to a registrar. And so they implemented and are testing both approaches in four hospitals, and they're scheduled to finish their project at the end of this month. So we are very much looking forward to hearing additional results from this group. This study recently came out, and there has been it's been very well received, and so we wanted to highlight it here as well. So that is So that's the end of my formal presentation. But now we can enter the discussion portion of this. And again, I have the questions outlined here. And you know, just kind of keeping in mind that now is the time that we're getting results. How do we start applying these results? What needs to be communicated? How can PCORI start communicating results and start and helping to address, with always keeping in mind addressing disparities in health and healthcare?
Thank you very much, Myra. I'm going to start off. I've got a number of people with their tags up. And so, you know, your questions really say how and who, and I would say and which channels as well is really something to think about, because I do think that PCORI's research, we started off this conversation by saying we know a lot about what's going on at CMMI and other places. How does PCORI equal or match? And I really like to highlight different media forms. You know, one of Modern Healthcare's entire booklet should be devoted to hear our results and their impact. Utilizing, it doesn't have to be Medscape, WebMD, but there are other services that give you that type of reach. And I like services that allow us to reach patients as well as providers. But I do think we have some opportunity there. The only comment I would have overall on some of these results is potential impact. I think we need to make sure that those statements make a statement. So, you know, the equality study that you mentioned, the findings, by the way, apply not to just to sexual orientation but to race and ethnicity as well. Well documented, people would rather it be just standardized in a manner. And so you could say the potential impact is standardizing within EMRs. How do you make that an ongoing criteria? And I would say the same for some of the potential impact for serious mental illness. And to some extent, we're saying you need like-minded providers, services, community. And I think those are strong statements that need to be made, and we probably should try to make those strong statements, because I'm not sure if they don't come from us, if there's anyone else who will be making them. With turn it over to Eleanor.
So I would come back about how you disseminate and how you get information out there. You have a very valuable resource. People who come to PCORI meetings. They might not all be investigators. There's, I met at the one meeting I went to, plenty of people who were from the community who were interested in topics, interested in helping to get research for what their health issues were. So if you've got committed individuals, try to figure out the different interest groups and start there. Because once you've got someone who's committed, if you look at dissemination or diffusion research, you start with the people who are committed first, and then it starts going outwards. So, you know, if you could figure out, and I believe on some of the, when you sign up for the meetings, it asks you what your interests are and what group you represent, so you could do some matching. And again, I mentioned earlier, maybe set up some Skype meetings and have people be a part of it initially and get the information out there that way, and then do secondary. So that's the first thing. And the other is to also do some matching with investigators, with other investigators. In addition to the people who have been funded, you've got people who haven't been funded but still have an interest maybe in the same topic, and bring together people for that for dissemination.
Thank you, Eleanor. Dorian, please.
Echo Eleanor's comments, and in particular the affiliation mapping for people who are either PCORI ambassadors and also people who are participating in the patient engagement advisory panel. A couple of questions around the framing of the presentation, and I appreciate the comment that you made about now having programming in 34 states. We've seen maps of where PCORI has funding in the past just as a framing and introduction, and one of the things that we saw in prior presentations were gaps in particular geographic areas, and so if there's an opportunity to bring that back, I think that I would really appreciate that. The other question that I had when I was taking a look at the information that was there is the issue of why are there so many mental health projects? Is this something that's representing or demonstrating a gap in other funding mechanisms, and if there are ways to perhaps partner with either other voluntary health organizations or other funders around this, because it just strikes me that the preponderance of mental health proposals that have come through has been pretty strong and consistent throughout the funding that's taken place through the Addressing Disparities portfolio.
Thank you. Great point. Danielle.
Thanks for the presentation. So I'm just going to throw a series of things out, and some of this you may already be doing, some of it may not be appropriate, but thinking about kind of the physician piece, just kind of general physician, clinician awareness about this research, if they're not a grantee or being funded, is the thought behind maybe hosting another conference a year that is not as focused on the grantees but has a broader audience where you would offer CME, and it would really kind of be very thoughtful about who to invite for that. Maybe asking grantees when the work is completed to commit to a certain amount of grand rounds in their community. And then maybe for PCORI, just to kind of have a list of targeted medical conferences each year that you would go staff or grantees and present, looking at particular medical journals to maybe do, obviously a lot of this work is getting published, but to do some type of overarching supplement where you're presenting the research together and maybe tying it to some particular policies that are relevant, that are going to catch folks' attention versus just the actual research itself. Maybe thinking in terms of who should be targeted in the communication channels, some of the actual disease interest groups that are working and have kind of coalesced a community around this. And, you know, the next are kind of maybe thinking outside of the box, but one of the things I found very interesting about CDC is CDC is coming to the realization that a lot of folks both in their community in Atlanta and across the country don't really understand what they do on a day-to-day basis, including physicians and clinicians. And what they do is incredibly important, and they're very worried about funding. And so they've started to host a series of open houses, both in Atlanta and D.C., where they invite stakeholders, members of Congress, policymakers that are not necessarily your typical researcher, to come and learn about what CDC does. And so D.C. is the perfect town to do that in, and it could be a really amazing approach to bring folks that may have heard of the name of PCORI but are not going to give it a second thought in terms of thinking about the work you're doing. And the last thing I'll say about CDC is some folks in the room may know that CDC has a current campaign going on where they're engaging physicians and payers. It's called 618, so focusing on the six most common and costly preventable chronic disease and 18 of the evidence-based strategies that we know works. And so one of the things that we could think about doing is how we implement some of this research as they expand their evidence base to be included and working with them on their campaign, because it's certainly growing in awareness in the physician community.
Thank you very much. Great comments. Ron.
Thanks for the presentation. I guess what occurred to me as you were going through the presentation and then into with these questions is, are you asking these questions about ways to communicate and think through that to supplement a pre-existing communication strategy from PCORI, or is this symptomatic of the absence of a communication strategy? And the reason I ask that is because all of the things that you heard, which all make perfect sense to me and I resonate with all of them, including the examples of kind of what CDC is doing, you know, you communicate for a purpose. You know, part of it is education. Part of it is promotion of the entity so that as relates to investment, funding, and other things or prominence or a strong voice that people want to listen to, people have to know what you do and what value it brings and so on. And then at the end of the day, all the folks who are trying to eliminate disparities want to know, ask the so what question. So you funded a bunch of studies, a lot of studies done, you have a broad portfolio, but what difference is it making in the implementation of addressing disparities and showing evidence of gaps being removed? So when you think about all of those potential reasons for communicating, that says you have to have a communication strategy that is very specific about which of those different roles you want to play with communications, all or a subset, and then what's your framework for doing that. So I think if you have that and you're asking for suggestions on how this work in this broad portfolio now can be infused into that, that's one problem to solve. But if you're asking this because we're doing this in a fragmented way and there's no existing framework for communication strategy, then I think that's the place to start.
Yeah, I appreciate that question for clarification. PCORI has a broad overall communication framework and is highlighting results for our project. I think in addressing disparities, we are uniquely positioned because we have made this substantial investment in specifically targeting these populations, and so we really want to look at our portfolio in a sense, how we address these disparities. So it's sort of within the broad PCORI communication strategy, and what should we be doing as a program ourselves to highlight these pieces.
Thank you. Great question. And actually, a follow-up would be, it'd be great, I think, for this group to be aware of what the communication PCORI strategy is. That would be a great deliverable as a follow-up email. Next, I'll go to Liz.
Thank you. So I think there's a couple ways that can be disseminated. Number one, I got a letter from my senator when I received a PCORI grant congratulating me, and I definitely plan to share with her the results and the impact we've had. So in addition, I've gone to each site where my study is conducted. It's a peer-to-peer support of older adults, where older adults and their peer supporters come in and provide incredible testimonials to the power of the program. Now, I hope the evidence actually shows that as well. But for them, it has a lot of face validity, and we plan to videotape them and use that as a way of communicating with people the power of the work. So I think the human face, in addition to the results, is really powerful. And then the last thing is that we plan to go to a lot of aging services organizations with our results, and with that have a toolkit for how you do the program. So we're already working on it. The three sites that have this program are working on it, which really comes to the dissemination and implementation. Like if you go and you say this is a great program, but you have no way to help people actually implement it or practice it in their own community, it's not going to go very far. So those are the three things that I think are could be really powerful.
Thank you, Liz. Don.
So first, I applaud Liz for this toolkit idea, because that's exactly where I was going to go with this. Without some connection to how to implement or make these sustainable, communication isn't all that. I mean, it's great. It's peer-reviewed journals and meeting presentations, but if the goal is to really move these things out into communities, I think that becomes a part. So I love this idea of the competitive or the limited competition grants, because they're so disparate, these projects, that I think some of it has to fall to the researchers to say, here's how this moves forward. I mean, I think the least they should be doing is saying if they're going to continue on with their interventions. That is an unbelievably powerful tool. If they say, well, as soon as the fund, and I'm not picking on anybody, but when I asked Donna if they were going to continue, and she said, well, you know, it's not free, and I get that. But if you can only do it as part of a research study, then it's really not going to address the equity and the disparity. So I hope some of those types of things come through. But to that same, then to begin thinking about who are your advocates? Who are the people who will make this happen? And I think that's, again, where the patients, I think some focus on payers, you know, and I realize without touching any third rails about where this goes, but, you know, that those are the people who will ultimately decide whether these interventions do get implemented, do get sustained. So I really, wherever there's an opportunity to get those people, I think that's got to be a key consideration.
Great comments, and I think you kind of started some of this. I think you'd go down that path of here's the impact, here's what can happen. I think building that out is what you're hearing. Next on the list, I think I have Deidre, and then Ken.
So Deidre Cruz, so just a really brief idea is thinking about Twitter chats. So with the investigators, so after they've published their work, especially having the investigator, you know, on a chat, but also potentially policymakers and payers who, and maybe others, if you invited them to be a part of that chat and had kind of a conversation back and forth about what the implications are of the work, I think that might be a way to kind of get the word out about the study and hopefully start and continue a conversation about its findings.
Great point. Ken, please.
Ken Mayer, really interesting presentation. I think not all findings are equally actionable, and that's why, you know, I think it's great to have a generic strategy, but I also think you want to focus. So you know, I endorse what Danielle said about getting out to meetings and thinking about professional organizations. I think particularly some of the work that you're doing around cultural competence, if there really are hard findings, then going back to the relevant professional organizations, it may be AAMC, so that we early education, maybe national nursing organizations. You know, so I think there's some key stakeholders to show the value added of PCORI to say this really would, you know, if you add this to your curriculum, it's going to be very important downstream. Some things aim high. I mean, I think if some of these findings show real comparative effectiveness, that may be relevant for the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, which, you know, at least to have them have a conversation so that as they're considering guidelines, that some of the information will be PCORI-generated information, and certainly that will have an impact on some payers. CDC was mentioned in one context, but I think CDC and HRSA are both natural partners for some of the other findings that come out of the studies. They have a suite of training centers. So CDC has a variety of prevention training centers where they already are funding groups to train providers or to work with other key constituencies. So feeding the funding into them. So maybe starting to have higher level meetings with them now if you haven't already and saying, you know, this is the kind of things we're funding. Who are the people we should talk to? I mean, HRSA has almost two dozen of these, provider training centers. So clearly some of these things, you can establish best practices and they can be the disseminators of the findings from the work that you're funding.
Thank you, Ken. Cincy.
Hi, this is Cincy Hernandez-Cancio. So I guess my first reaction is to those specific questions. I think it's
very important to you guys are pretty good at having these networks to talk to researchers and clinicians. And I think the area that needs more support, and it may be a stretch, is talking to families, patients, consumers, and advocates, right? And I think that the advocate piece, you know, organizations like ours are kind of the channel or the link in many ways between, you know, we're used to taking very wonky, complicated things and kind of distilling it down, like we're like a step-down transformer, right? So that kind of regular people understand what's going on and are able to engage. I think that it's very exciting. It would be very exciting for some advocates who have been struggling for years in the health equity world to think about how do we make, we know there's things out there that work really well for our communities, but they're not getting attention. You know, they push back and say, well, where's the evidence for that? And the advocates don't feel necessarily like, where's my menu of things that I should be advocating for in the event that I'm even invited to be at these tables about what should value, how is value defined, and what should be paid for, right? So, you know, any work, I mean, we can talk more about specific tactics about like webinars or Twitter chats or Facebook Live or, you know, all these other things, but I think that the first step is really being clear about how do you reach that kind of audience and what kind of different messaging needs to be available for that audience to be able to make it actionable for them. The first thing that I would say, though, is you need a more user-friendly website, right? So, like, right now, like we have Families USA right now is funded to do some work on advancing community health workers and funding through Medicaid with them, right? I try to look up what's the community health worker portfolio, and it's impossible to find. Like, the first thing is about whether you want to interview or do focus groups to find out what people want. That is not helpful. And so if you have a state-level or, you know, state-level advocate, health equity person who says, oh, let me see what I can find out to advance my, you know, things for my community, and they get that, they're like, you know, you guys are useless to me, right? One suggestion, although it has its own issues, is I don't know if you've heard about the playbook for that came out of kind of the National Center for Complex Care. So they have a much more user-friendly site where part of it, you know, you have a menu where it says, I want better care for, and you can pick, like, they don't have minorities in there. They don't have, like, something we'd like to see. But you have a way of kind of channeling the reader's experience to the kind of things they're looking for. They also have a way of saying, I am a what? And you have, like, leader of a healthcare system. They don't have an advocate or patient on that list. They should. We're working with them on that. But that would be another way. It's like, I am a patient. You know, I am an advocate. How do I navigate the information that you have? And so I would say that any whether you're doing a Twitter chat, Facebook, you know, definitely go to all the conferences you can and get ambassadors and all of that. But if you don't have a website to take people back to, you've lost them. You know, you've spent all that time getting people interested and then not giving them something they can use.
Thank you, Cincy. Tim, please.
You know, it's a fascinating conversation about communication strategy. It reminded me, I heard a senior, I think it was a vice chancellor at my institution, not on the healthcare system side, but on the university side, talked about how things have changed in the way of dissemination. And what he said is that there are three ways that you communicate. It sounds pretty radical or heretical. Number one, you can buy it. Or second, that you own it. And third, you can influence it. And among other academics, you could sort of feel the uncomfort in the room, but when you think about where we are today, in where media is, it's not that far from the truth. And I think a lot of times we tack into the third element of trying to influence. And so the notion of, well, how do you own something? And there's a reason why, I'm not saying we go out and buy the New York Times, et cetera, but you control the message that's there as well. And so when you think about who are the different stakeholders, what message that you have, you know, there are venues that are available to you and the relationships that you have. You know, what do you buy? And I would say throughout the day, each of us went on our website and began to Google something. There is a mechanism that Google has that different types of audiences or people can purchase when you Google something, that there's a hierarchy that you go through that people pay for. And so that's a strategy when you're thinking about if you're a staffer on the Hill of Health Legislative Aid, when they look up something, how do you begin to get in the queue that you're the first person that comes up rather than health affairs, et cetera. You know, and as I said, the latter part, I think all of us are very familiar with the influence, but the times have changed when you begin to look at those two elements. And I'm still adjusting that notion of, okay, do you buy it or do you own it? But largely, we sort of seek to influence it.
Great point. buying it is okay when you have great stuff to share, too. Barbara.
Thanks. I kind of agree with everything that Sensei said. I think there's a lot of messaging that can be done, and I think that, you know, I am going to say something about webinars and Facebook Live, because I think there needs to be messaging. There needs to be a website that's usable. And, you know, I just looked on Facebook, and there's 1,300 and change followers, which was shocking to me, because, I mean, I have, you know, I have a support group for people with chronic pain that's got over 10,000 people in it. And, it just seems like if you did some Facebook Lives, if you let people know what you were, there'd be a lot of followers. And I think, you know, when I talk, I have a P2P grant, and when I talk to our members and I tell them that this organization wants to know what patients think and feel, everybody's in shock, and they're, like, so turned on by that. Somebody cares about what we think? It is so empowering. And there are literally thousands of support groups on Facebook. I did a small, what was supposed to be a qualitative study on one condition, and I had 250 people respond to, you know, something that nobody's ever heard of. And they were writing to me and saying, I'm so glad you asked us. And I had quantitative data. I had to go back to the IRB and make it mixed methods because I had so many people. But they want to talk. They want their voices heard. When they hear there's an organization that's listening, it's like, oh, my gosh, somebody's actually listening to us. And I think that is so empowering, and I think the power of PCORI could just be, you know, exponential if all of these groups realize that there's a group out there that wants to know what you want and wants to know how you think care can be improved.
Thank you. I have two more. I have Terry and then Christine. Terry.
Terry Black. I agree with much of the discussion. A couple things that do come to mind. I do think that in terms of the strategy, depending who your target audience is, as Danielle mentioned, your strategies are going to vary. The other thing, too, the obvious ones have been mentioned, you know, with professional associations. I'm thinking, you know, from I'm a nurse, so nursing groups, American Academy of Nursing, public health organizations. The professional associations would be interested, as well as AARP, you know, consumer groups, things of that nature. But I think it needs to be something meaningful, and it's going to be utilized. So I've seen one-pagers used, so whether it's a one-pager in terms of having clinicians aware of some of these studies and results and how they can use it to inform patients, as well as maybe a one-pager that patients can use as a summary of some of these studies. How will that inform their decisions? What questions now should they ask in terms of talking points when, if it's a condition or a diagnosis that affects them, how can they use that as a springboard for discussions with their care practitioner? So I think it's just getting it out there is one thing, but I think it needs to be practical and meaningful, and I think those strategies are going to be very different depending on if you're targeting a professional group versus the consumer. And also don't forget about the PCORI ambassadors. There's a whole group there that's really at your beck and call that would, I know, be more than willing to get the word out as well.
Thank you, Terry. Christine?
Yeah, just briefly, I wanted to mention, I know that CDC used to have a program where they would actually help researchers who had evidence-based interventions that were ready to be disseminated. They would kind of help them package it and develop toolkits and that kind of thing. And I thought that might be helpful. You know, doing research is a lot different than, you know, dissemination and really getting it out there. So, you know, some researchers are not trained in implementation science, and so they may need a little help in getting to that next step.
Please, Danielle.
So I like tactics, and I just want to share one observation in thinking about audience from a preventive medicine clinician point of view. From where I sit, I have a great opportunity to talk to PCORI with all of our members at the American College of Preventive Medicine. And one thing struck me is that if our members were in academia or research, they were aware of PCORI, but they didn't think of it in any meaningful way beyond a funding source. If our members were involved in just direct clinical care or were a chief medical officer or in kind of another kind of non-academic, they had no awareness of PCORI. It just wasn't on their radar. And I thought, you know, from a communication strategy, that's an interesting note. This sounds really simple. I'm not sure if you do it, but a monthly or quarterly bi-monthly newsletter to different audience, so maybe the patient, the researcher, the average clinician, the health system, with kind of targeted different messages would help a lot. So I create our communications for ACPM, and I have to really dig to find information that I think is meaningful about PCORI to put in my newsletters. And if you kind of just develop these newsletters over time, most folks that I interact with, in even myself, have only 4 or 5 trusted communication channels that we read every day or help guide us on kind of the latest evidence or resource. And PCORI could become one of those in different settings, written in different ways for different audiences. I think it could go a long way for the non-grantees to start becoming embedded in the culture. And it would also help people like me easily take things from your newsletters or website and then incorporate it into the preventive medicine community.
Thank you very much. And I think we've talked a lot about communications today. Actually, we started out talking about communications, right? Mission statements, what are we combining, how are we looking at that, how are we taking input, all the way through what's our communication strategy, what are the things we're adding, and at the end of the day, it's everything from how do you get refunded, how do you bring new partners in, what are your metrics of your own success, and I do think we have not, to my knowledge, spent time on what percentage of our budget do we spend on communications, and the real value that has, not just in getting it to the Hill, to senators, to communities, to academicians, to clinicians, to patients. And it's a really important piece. And so we asked about bringing back what's the communication strategy and maybe understanding it within the realm of PCORI down to our panels. And then how much are we devoting to that? And how are we leveraging that? Because as we all know today, I think the point is well made. Today, communications mean a lot, and a lot of groups understand the power of that, and we've seen how it can happen. We have to take advantage, I think, of those. So hopefully, Myra, as Steve's learning, lots of input, but good input.
Dorian wanted to have a quick thing
to add. Oh, go ahead, Dorian.
Earlier comment that I made about, thank you, Dorian Miller, why there are so many mental health proposals that are funded. This is meta information that it's important to know, particularly for people who are in advocacy positions, because they can also take a look at not just the direct research findings, but also the field in general and why there's a need for additional research and opportunities to link patient-centeredness to a particular category. And that is not necessarily the communication of a direct research finding, but the trend data around what's being funded and what people are asking for.
And though I was saying that we give a lot of comments, I think I speak for everyone here when I say we will help make it happen as well. So it's not to, go back and here's our feedback, go do that. I think we're here to commit. And by the way, I mean that for including the people who are coming off the panel. I just want to make sure that's on record. I'd like that in the minutes. We actually are on time. We will be taking a 15-minute break. Please be back at 3 o'clock. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
wish I was going to give it to you, because I know you have to leave, right?
Yeah, no, for us. I want to get it from you.
So great to meet you.
Yeah.
Oh, you were? Oh, because of the meeting? Yeah, I didn't realize that was here. I mean, that's
I can't have it.
everyone. We're going to restart. I'll invite you to take a seat, bring your treats. This is probably the only meeting I go to that there isn't a hashtag going on throughout the meeting. We may have found our Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel communication Twitter lead. Thank you, Tung.
So we're going to hear a presentation by Idola. I just want to let you know that we are working to end the meeting at 4 p.m. We hear a lot of people have to leave, so that's our goal. You're welcome. Unless you want the meeting to go on longer.
Except Donald.
Okay, Idola is going to present to us on the asthma research framework, and I don't think Idola needs more of an introduction. We all know her as a program officer here with the Addressing Disparities program.
Thank you, Liz. So as many of you know, I've been working on asthma at PCORI since about 2013, so I am always excited to talk about some of the work that we're doing and how we're progressing. I do want to acknowledge Julia Anderson and Deanna Attenson, who also work very closely with me on managing the asthma wards as well as the Asthma Evidence to Action Network. If you didn't notice, all three of us have last names that start with A, so we're giving a whole new meaning to the A team. So the primary focus of today's presentation is to talk about our draft Asthma Evidence to Action Network framework. But before we go into the framework, I do want to provide you with some background on the Asthma Evidence to Action Network and then discuss the potential impact of the network, and then also talk about some of the activities that we have been doing this year as well as what we are considering doing as we move forward. So just as a reminder, the network has two goals. The first is to engage asthma awardees and facilitate cross-learning among funded projects throughout PCORI. When we think about cross-learning and engagement, we're not just thinking about CER awardees. We're thinking about the patients and the stakeholder partners that work with them. And we're also thinking about projects that have been funded throughout PCORI that look at engagement. So just understand that this is not just cross-learning among researchers, but this is also more broad. The second goal is to link asthma awardees with end users to make sure that we have an opportunity to enhance the relevance of the evidence and to increase the likelihood of uptake of findings. And so a lot of the activities that we've started doing, whether it's in-person meetings or hosting webinars, is trying to make sure that we have an opportunity to reach out to end users, whether they're payers, advocacy organizations, or professional societies, as well as others. This is not an eye test. And so there is a copy of this slide in your packets, and I think this goes to Dorian's point about always making sure that we have some maps to show the geographic variation in some of the projects. But within the asthma network, we have 17 projects. There was a recent project that was funded, and so that now makes 17. So again, as you can see, there's some geographic variation in terms of what we have funded. And there are variation in terms of the populations that are being studied as well as the interventions that are being tested. But there are also a lot of similarities between the projects. And I show you this map, and I'm going to just talk at a very high level about the projects that are in the network because I think it's important as we start to talk about the framework for what PCORI has funded. Because we want to make sure that the framework is representative of everything that we funded and gives us a roadmap of how we know that we've actually had some impact. So in what I think is purple are the 9 Addressing Disparities Program asthma studies. 8 of those studies are targeted to improve patient and clinician adherence to the National Asthma Education Prevention Program guidelines. And they do that in a variety of different ways. But all 8 projects are actually focused on reducing asthma disparities in African Americans and Hispanics and Latinos. There's another study that's a pragmatic clinical study, and it's looking more at changing the way that patients take their asthma medication to see if that changes asthma outcomes. And that's also focused on African Americans and Hispanics and Latinos. We have two projects that are within our communication and dissemination research program area, and those two projects are looking at improving patient and provider communication and also using tools around shared decision making. We have two projects that are in the Improving Healthcare Systems program or portfolio, and they're looking at implementing new tools to connect with the healthcare system and also using high deductible health plans with and without preventative drug lists. There are two programs, two awards that are pipeline to proposal awards. And if you remember, the pipeline to proposal awards were geared towards building capacity among communities. So they're not doing research per se. Their goal is to really be able to get to a point where they have stakeholders that they have identified important research questions and can ultimately apply for research, whether that's at PCORI or other agencies, but the research is focused on patient-centered outcomes. We have one engagement award, and that engagement award is focused on training patients with asthma to understand patient-centered outcomes research. And then we have one project that's within our PCORNET team, and they're looking at more broadly ways to improve the infrastructure around allowing us to conduct research in a more effective and efficient way. So this particular project is looking at multiple conditions, and asthma is one of them. So this is our portfolio of asthma projects, and it's something that we are really excited about, and it gives us an opportunity to talk about the various projects and different ways that they're addressing asthma and improving asthma outcomes. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the potential impact of the Asthma Evidence to Action Network. This was a slide that we developed at the very beginning of the network, and I'm actually really excited to talk about some of the things that we're seeing actually take shape. So one of the aims that we have been working towards in terms of the impact that we can see with the network is increasing the capacity of researchers and patients and stakeholder partners in the network to be able to engage in patient-centered outcomes research. And so we're starting to see some really cool, to use a technical term, examples of how this is taking shape. So we have a pipeline to proposal awardee who was at one of our in-person meetings, and they're based in Seattle. And we also have a CER awardee that's based in Seattle. And so they started talking and started engaging with each other and actually applied for an NIH grant together. And so for the pipeline to proposal awardee, they were actually really excited because for them, this is their first foray into really starting to understand patient-centered outcomes research. And so now they have a partner that can work with them to actually move that forward. Another example of where we're seeing this increase in capacity is with an awardee who is in the Addressing Disparities program. And so this is an awardee that's in Boston, and they're looking at medication and changing the way patients take their medication. And so they have 14 sites across the United States, but even though they haven't started recruitment, they want to make sure that they don't run into any challenges. And so at our last Asthma Evidence to Action Network meeting, which was in March, they actually identified two awardees whose projects are ending who said, our sites would be more than happy to work with you. So these are connections that are really starting to take place and really moving the research process forward. The second potential impact for the network is to speed the implementation and use of patient-centered outcomes research evidence. We've all heard that statistic that it takes over 17 years for less than 10% of research evidence to actually be used into practice. Well, at PCORI, we do not have 17 years, and so we hope that the work that we're doing here really starts to drive that forward. The third potential impact has to do with providing a cohort of projects that allow us to measure the uptake and usefulness of evidence by end users outside of the research project. And so while we're waiting for that evidence to become available, out of the 13 research projects that we have that are comparative effectiveness research projects, I believe only two or three of them have actually completed their projects and have results. So while we're waiting for the results to be available, we're really starting to see some uptake and use of tools and interventions that are taking place outside of the research studies. So for example, in California, the John Elder Project is comparing a family and clinic intervention that's nested within a community intervention. And the clinics, as part of the intervention, have modified their staffing and workflow, and they use asthma educators and case managers. Some of the system changes that they've made include asthma care templates that are tailored and include prompts for clinicians to use in shared decision making. And so while we wait for results, the community understands that the changes that are taking place in the clinic are really valuable and important as a basic part of asthma care. So clinics outside of the county where the study is taking place have started to make these clinic improvements. So again, this is where we're starting to see implementation and uptake even without there being research results. Also, we have one study that's in New York, and it's focused on older patients with asthma, and they are comparing clinic-based support by an asthma care coach to home-based self-management by a community health worker and usual care. And so they've developed an asthma assessment tool and an asthma action plan to use with the cohort of patients that they're recruiting, and they're recruiting older patients, excuse me. And the community health workers love this tool so much so that they've actually started using it with patients that aren't eligible for the study. So there are a lot of early impacts that are taking place, and what we're trying to do is start to capture that. And the benefit of starting to capture these early impacts is that even without results, we can use this to start telling the story of what PCORI has funded. Okay, so what have we been doing this year? In March, as I mentioned, we held an in-person meeting, and this is the third annual in-person meeting. And we've been told that this was the best meeting out of all three. So not to toot our own horns, but toot toot. And so as you heard in Myra's presentation, that this notion of capturing stories is something that's really important to us. And given that we have a cohort of 17 projects, this is there's a very natural way that we can start to tell the story of not just the challenges for patients around asthma, but the studies that PCORI has funded, why we funded them, early impacts, and then results. But we need to come up with a very cohesive framework and strategy to start doing that. One of my favorite quotes is, "Statistics are human beings with the tears wiped off." And so we will have research results, but those results, those numbers, are not enough. And so we need to start being able to capture real stories from patients, from stakeholders, about what we funded and how that information can be used and useful. As I mentioned, we've also started to identify some early impacts. The early impacts really range from collaboration to taking engagement to another level, and these are elements that really help tell the story. And then one of the things that we've started to do, and I'm going to share this framework with you, is to develop a draft framework that talks about the portfolio. So we presented the portfolio at the in-person meeting, and we were able to get some really good feedback, and so we revised the framework, so you're seeing Framework 2.0. And we want to get your input so that we can take it to the next step. In terms of next steps for this year, there are some things that we hope to be able to do. One is, and this is just a short list, so this is not everything. But we hope to be able to start to do webinars, not just to have stakeholders talk to our awardees about what they value and what's important to them, but I think this is really an opportunity for our awardees that actually do have research results to start sharing information with those stakeholders who might be interested in it. It's low cost, it doesn't require anybody to travel, I think something that's very easy for us to do. Also, in addition to having a framework that shows our portfolio and how we aim to improve outcomes, starting to think about an evidence synthesis or evidence mapping. This is something that Evelyn Whitlock, our chief science officer, mentioned several meetings ago. And is of interest to her. And I think that this helps to really put a frame around what we funded, how we're addressing specific evidence gaps, and if there are additional gaps that we could be addressing, it just really identifies that for us very clearly. Another area that we're beginning to brainstorm about is this notion of data aggregation, not just in terms of processes of the studies, but there may be an opportunity for us, especially given that there are similarities among the studies. So, for example, we have four research projects that use community health workers to improve the home environment. And so this might be an opportunity for us to start thinking about, once they have results, if we can aggregate those results. We know that stakeholders are not as interested in one study, and if there's a way that we can bring multiple studies together, that really helps. Okay, so to get to the asthma portfolio framework, I wanted to, before we do that, talk about some of the purposes of the framework. We wanted to be able to show PCORI's investment and how it can have an influence on improving asthma outcomes and reducing disparities. And so this is our opportunity to link all 17 projects into a coherent structure that is accessible, that is meaningful, and generalizable. So regardless of whether a project is in is focused on CER, engagement, or infrastructure, that we can tell a cohesive story. We also thought that this framework could be useful for not just PCORI. So we do have various payers and other stakeholders who are coming to us to say, what have you funded? We can show them this framework. But it could also be useful for our awardees and researchers to talk about where their portfolios, where their projects fit into the PCORI asthma portfolio, both when they're writing manuscripts or when they're applying to PCORI for dissemination and implementation funding. One of the things that came out of the in-person meeting was this notion of actually working as teams collaboratively across multiple projects to apply for dissemination and implementation funding. So the third purpose of the framework could be to inform future asthma research. So it could help us to make reasoned and defensible choices about unexplored areas of asthma research. So before I show you the framework, I just have two caveats. One is that we were trying to really strike a balance between capturing enough information about the projects without being too granular. So keep that in mind. The second caveat is that we are not design experts or communication experts. So the image that you are going to see is flat, it is unidimensional, and it is not creative at all. So our aim... our aim is to make sure that the information in the framework is right. So I'll just throw that out there. And then one more thing before we get to the framework is we thought that we would present to you some of the questions that we had about the framework. Certainly we're open to other comments and questions that you might have. But these are some of the questions that came up from our presentation to the asthma awardee team members and things that we are still trying to figure out how to address. So the framework is in your packets, and I'm not going to read through the questions, but they are here. And then we'll also show them at the end for the discussion. Okay, and this is not another eye test either. So I'll just quickly go through the draft framework. So on the left, you see impact. Originally, when we started with the framework, we had barriers on the left. And we thought, given that people read from left to right, and that we really want the focus to be on impact, that we would put impact on the left. So you can see that our aim is to improve asthma outcomes and to reduce asthma disparities. And that is where we hope to be able to have some impact with the 17 projects that we've funded. To the right of that, you see what we are considering the drivers of practice change. Those include quality measures, guideline adherence, technology, coverage and payment policy, sustainability, feasibility, and feasibility of implementation. Excuse me. One of the topics that our E2AN members brought up was that these actually aren't drivers of policy change. And so we'd like your thinking on what are the appropriate drivers, because as somebody mentioned, quality measures in and of themselves don't lead you to improved asthma outcomes. There's something else that happens. There's some mechanism that's taking place that we haven't captured. To the right of that are our outcomes. And so we have patient-reported outcomes all the way from asthma quality of life to caregiver satisfaction to missed school or work days to psychosocial stress. We have clinical outcomes. Given that engagement in research is something that PCORI is really trying to improve, as well as engagement of patients and clinicians in shared decision-making, we have outcomes around engagement. And then knowing that, you know, in addition to numbers and results and engagement, that there's a lot of qualitative information that should be counted as an outcome from the studies, to Barbara's point earlier. and so we included that as a potential outcome that then, you know, would lead to practice change and then lead to impact. To the right of outcomes, we have strategies, and these are really what we're seeing in the projects that we funded. Again, these projects span comparative effectiveness research projects, engagement, and so we wanted to be able to capture what's taking place in the projects. So we have interventions ranging from tools, asthma action plans, patient and clinician education, use of EHRs. We have strategies that include how you share information with patients and how physicians and patients actually work together to make decisions. And then we have strategies around patient and stakeholder engagement in research that really addresses some of the pipeline to proposal awards and other engagement awards that we have. To the right of that, we have the stakeholders, and these are the folks that really are the decision makers and who need information in order to help them make informed decisions. And they help to inform the strategies that are used in the projects that we have funded. And also are the ones that really go through the decisional dilemmas. And then to the right of the stakeholders, you have the barriers. And so the barriers include asthma care, access, quality, but they also include communication and dissemination challenges, so barriers around shared decision-making, visit involvement, team interaction, all the way to strategies to get findings out to end users. There are barriers in engagement. Hopefully, PCORI is helping to change that and changing the landscape about patient and stakeholder engagement more broadly in research. And then there are barriers around infrastructure to conducting research to get at some of the infrastructure projects that we have that help us to recruit and retain patients, but also developing materials and tools. So I will stop there. Actually, one more slide. so this actually shows the settings and the populations that the 17 studies are taking place in. And so we have most of the projects taking place in the clinic, with 6 taking place in the home, 3 taking place in the community, and 2 in the healthcare system. We have 1 project that's in the emergency room. And then populations, it should say 17 under patients with asthma, but we have racial ethnic minorities. There are 12 projects, 10 projects look at low income. We have 9 projects that look at adults, 2 that focus on the elderly, and 8 projects that focus on children. So just to give you a little bit of context about where the studies are and projects are taking place, as well as the populations. We couldn't fit it all into 1 slide, so that was why we did it in 2. Okay. So back to the discussion questions.
Thank you, Ayodhya. So I have Breen, Dawn, and Cynthia. I'm going to start. There are a couple things that I would add to your draft framework. First is a question. When you say drivers of practice change, you're thinking what's going to make a healthcare system potentially change their practice? Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, and you know, the legislation does call out the need to change practice.
Okay.
And so we want to make, you know, so we're mm-hmm. we're thinking of
right.
within that context.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's 2 things missing here. I think 1 is a return on investment and monetary benefits that come from this. I'm so struck by what we've been talking about in terms of community health workers, and there's so much work going on in this area, and they're never sustained for reasons that completely boggle my mind because they're so cost effective. And thinking about I think that this is a meta question for PCORI and other organizations. How do we actually start integrating them more effectively into the healthcare system and actually get them paid for? And then for stakeholders, there's a couple of stakeholders I would add. Schools and employers, because kids aren't in school or people are not coming to work if their asthma is not fully managed. And I think there's advocacy organizations and community-based organizations. So my guess is, you know, for instance, there might be a healthy kids organization for Latinos or something that's all about, like, getting mites out of the house, providing air conditioners. I mean, there's other organizations that really care about this that aren't represented on those lists. So that's what I was going to add.
Thank you.
Umbreen?
Hi, I'm Breena Hall. Thank you so much for that presentation. And I wanted to call out a couple of things that I applaud. One is the aggregation of data because, again, speaking from the payer perspective, you are absolutely right. Small studies often, which are, you know, which is what is feasible in the disparities research, is not actionable for on a population level for payers. And so to the extent that studies can be aggregated, you can think about sort of how they influence each other. That's really wonderful, and I think that's really helpful. And then it's great that you guys are thinking broadly and being creative about the framework, but I would just caution that I feel like it is a bunch of sort of like boxes, and even though I understand why you would start with impact first, I do think when I think about a framework, I think about sort of understanding like an organism and how these different parts interact with each other, and so having a flow as to these are the drivers that interact with each other, and this is the outcome might be important, and to the extent that it can be tied to the broader sort of framework, you know. So, for instance, this one here for the different, you know, if there could be some internal consistency within the organization so that when there's an ability to sort of think logically and think, okay, well, if I do this, if then sort of things. And then this, I think, also gets because they're kind of concentric circles, it gets to intersectionality, whereas I feel like when you have boxes, it's a little challenging because then it seems like these things are circumscribed, where in fact there's a lot of kind of, bi-directional things overlap. Last thing I'll say is in terms of stakeholders is often community organizations that may not be overtly health-related, like faith-based groups or community centers, libraries, there may be multiple ways of reaching folks. Certainly for some of the healthcare enrollment work, that was HHS and CMS and the White House reached out through such organizations, and so that might be something to think about for stakeholders. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have Don Cincy and then Dorian.
So first of all, I think this is great. I mean, you undersold it. I think this is fantastic. I think this is well done. But it does leave me, as I go back to the purpose of it, you know, and if part of it is to inform future research, What I guess I would look for is, you know, what's the intensity or what is at what level have these questions now been answered? So that if I am a future researcher, is there a way for me to know where the gaps are? I mean, I think this gives a great overview of everything, but and maybe that's, you know, heat maps, maybe that's links coming out of there that will show me what it is. I mean, it'd be wonderful if you could just tell me what to do, but I don't think that's going to happen. So just if there was some way to make it a little bit more useful on that end. But otherwise, I think it's really nice.
Thank you.
That's
very helpful. Cincy? Yeah. Dorian?
So this is going to go along the lines of question number three, the considerations for discussing, for using different frameworks for various audiences. It comes back to the issue of being able to perhaps prioritizing the important factors in the interventions that have been developed and perhaps doing some work around synthesis. The question for me is whether or not, as I look at the various interventions and their impact, is this a bundled strategy, or has there been any work done in order to differentiate, is A, B, and F absolutely necessary in order to move the needle versus not? And I think that as you think about stratification for different audiences, that that type of work needs to take place.
Thank you. Grant?
Adola, thank you for the invitation to contribute to your draft, and I want to join you in being someone who has no sense of confidence about diagrams. But one of the things that jumps out at me about the framework you have outlined here is that the barrier
Grant,
that you...
Grant, can you use the microphone? I'm sorry, I just realized it was.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
This is Grant Jones. Mm-hmm. So the barriers that you list here... or obviously things that you've thought about and considered about what some of the barriers are, it seems to me that either in outcomes or strategies, you might want to consider it being inclusive of addressing the barriers, so that if there's a barrier that you acknowledge gets in the way of doing what you're trying, achieving what you're trying to achieve, at least somewhere in the outcomes or somewhere in the strategies, perhaps should be something that includes that barrier.
Thank you, Grant. And Cheryl?
Advocacy isn't clearly listed here, and I think at the end of the day, that's what really influences policy and payment. The comment about prioritization is really, really important. So I look at a framework as something that someone can pick up, and they can say, here are the five things I must have. Here are my nice-to-haves. Here's, well, these don't apply to me. I'm not sure how that would be utilized. And the communication piece, I mean, again, we keep coming back to it. How you would communicate this to different audiences requires, frankly, almost a multimedia strategy in being able to do that. And this is so important and so almost basic because it's not as if these are new evidence-based treatment programs we're coming up with. It's that we haven't yet figured out how to make it easy to use and access. And so, you know, the comment we made earlier this morning, I just want to come back to, some of these things are basic. We just haven't communicated them well, versus some of them are true discovering new evidence. And I think even within our PCORI portfolio, that's some work that we still need to do. But I think for this one in particular, how you get it out to all of these stakeholders will probably be, maybe you're the beta test for the communication strategy for what we do. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to, I hope you got good feedback, Idol, yeah? And we are now going to have a presentation by Barbara Cornwell.
And Barbara, as many of you are aware, is the CEO of the Coalition for Disability Health Equity and has really contributed a great deal to all of the work that we do across everything. And today, she's getting a chance to specifically talk about disparities and disabilities. So, Barbara.
Thank you. Sorry. So I've always been interested in intersectionality because I found out that if I just talked about disability-based health disparities, nobody listened. So when I went further into researching and looking at intersection, it just made more sense, and I could get people to listen to me. And I work a lot in the policy world, so having people listen to you is important. And I started out as an outsider, and then when I started talking about intersection, it was amazing what happened. So the question, what does disability mean? I think most people in this room know what that means. It's not that you're sick or unhealthy. It's not a bad outcome. You know, research studies a bad outcome is disability in a lot of them. And in the disability world, we look at it as just a difference that people live with, just like the other differences we talk about.
And this is the first article that's really been written in the literature talking about people with disabilities as an unrecognized health disparity population. It appeared in the APHA Journal. We advocated for HHS to do this paper, and they hired people to do it, and it got buried. So the person, one of the authors, left the government, took it with her, and published it. So we now have data that disabilities in emerging fields within public health, and that people with significant disabilities account for more than 12% of the U.S. population. And people we know with disabilities experience health disparities. They experience significant ones, barriers to care, as compared with people who do not have disabilities. And they meet the criteria for being a health disparity population. So the available evidence documents that people with disabilities meet all of the criteria. People with disabilities were institutionalized and marginalized for a long time. They experienced documented differences in health outcomes at a population level. They have higher rates of unmet needs, unhealthy lifestyles, mental health and chronic disease, and social determinants of poor health. People assume that people with disabilities have coverage because a lot of them are on Medicaid or Medicare. So they assume that, okay, you know, they get care, but having coverage, as we all know, doesn't mean that you get care, and especially if the office isn't accessible, if the doctor's office hangs up when you call with the TTY or through the relay service, or they just don't know how to treat you, or they, you know, the big problem we have is, you know, little things like people who are wheelchair users, they want to be weighed. You know, you go to the doctor, you get a physical, and they take your blood pressure, and they weigh you. And when I worked for Senator Harkin, we asked people to send us their stories, and one woman said that she hadn't been weighed in a long time, and she was getting medication. She wanted to know if she was getting the right dosages and everything. So she asked the doctor to weigh her, and he said, I don't have a way to weigh you. Go to the post office and see if they'll put you on the mail scale. So she did that, and the post office said, we're sorry, ma'am, we only weigh packages on the mail scale. So, you know, there are these lack of access to care that people just assume they're going to get. And finally, many of these are recognized as avoidable and disproportionately affecting this population. And so we know that people with disabilities are overrepresented in many target populations for public health intervention, from smoking to obesity to injury prevention, yet their presence in these groups is not recognized or accommodated. And as a group, people with disabilities experience more chronic conditions and experience them at earlier ages. And I'm going to show you some evidence. We know that 3 out of 5 people with serious mental illness die 25 years earlier than other individuals and from preventable conditions, diabetes, heart disease, you know, things that they can be treated for. But a lot of physicians don't want them in their offices. So, you know, they do whatever they can to get them out, and they don't look at their underlying health conditions. Inaccessible medical equipment, lack of trained physicians, dentists, and other health professionals are a real barrier, terrible barrier. So things like getting weighed, preventative dental care, pelvic exams. I got involved in this area because I had a, you know, I'm a lawyer and a health professional, so I had a legal client who I was seeing for an ADA issue, and she was paraplegic, actually quadriplegic. She catheterized herself, but low level, and she was seeing more blood in her urine. And it was like occult blood. And the doctor was saying, well, blood's normal when you catheterize. She said, not this much. Mm-hmm. So I called around. I couldn't get an OBGYN. I said to her, we got to, you know, go see an OBGYN. Let's start with that. Couldn't find one to see her. Finally, I found one who said, if you come and transfer her, because I told them I'm an OT, you transfer her and hold her legs up and help me examine her, and I'll do it. Stage 4 cervical cancer. She died 6 weeks later, and she was 28 years old. People who are deaf or experience significant hearing problems, they're 3 times more likely to report fair or poor health compared to people without hearing impairments. And they have difficulty, TTYs, when you call a doctor's office, they hang up. They don't want to go through the relay service. I had one doctor that I sued in my previous life. He wouldn't let the patient's adult daughter interpret for her because he said it was a HIPAA violation, and he wouldn't hire an interpreter for her. And this, you know, young woman had her interpreted for her mother her whole life. 27% of adults with major physical and sensory impairments are obese, compared with 19 among people without major impairments. This is data from Special Olympics. Individuals with intellectual disabilities have to go contact 50 doctors before they find one who's trained to treat them and feels competent treating them. 4.6% of deaf people are infected with AIDS, which is a huge number compared to the general population. And 50% of those with TBI or spinal cord injuries are substance abusers. Now, we've had numerous reports saying that we need to do something. You know, the IOM report, the Surgeon General's report, another IOM report, they all say we have to do something, but nothing's been done. Now, when looking at disability, the data that's collected from the public health surveys, the NHIS, et cetera, they divide people in terms of having difficulties with basic actions, which are functional limitations, limitations in vision or hearing, cognitive limitations, or people that use assistive technology. And then they look at another category of people that are more limitations called complex activity limitations. And these are people who have ADL, activity of daily living, and instrumental activity of daily living limitations, and limitations in work, social, or recreational activities. So the CDC reports that 62 million or 30% of Americans either have some difficulty with basic movement or sensory, emotional, cognitive problems, and 14% have that complex activity limitation, which includes their ability to participate in society, take care of their needs, run a household, cooking, pursuing hobbies, participation, et cetera. And that's from NHIS data, the National Health. Now, the Office of Minority Health calls the intersection a double burden. They say that aside from public health issues that most racial and ethnic minorities face, minorities with disabilities experience this additional disparity in health prejudice, discrimination, economic barriers, and difficulty accessing care as a result of their disability. So they call it a double burden. Charles Drum has called it an amplifying phenomenon, that individuals have this enormous health disparity amplifying phenomenon when you're at the intersection. And he also called it a challenging multiplier effect, the combination of racial and ethnic minority status and disability. Now, when you look at, this data came from Project Intersect, which is from one of the universities in CDC. And what they found, they looked at what happens when you have, when you're a member of racial and ethnic minority and you have a disability. So this data shows that if you have, if you're a member of multiple race, if you identify as multiple race, you have the highest incident of disability. And you can see the others. And as you add things, the questions that people ask, the percent with complex activity limitations among those with a disability, so this is the intersection, you see that Alaska Natives and American Indians move up the food chain there. And people multiple race also are up the food chain. Hispanics move up. I mean, you look at this, the previous one, and look what happens. Boom. It's, you know, it's just profound. And then people that report fair and poor health compared to people without disabilities. I mean, you know, it's just startling, absolutely startling. And again, you know, the larger group is Alaska Natives and American Indians. And then mental health, people who report mental health issues versus fair and poor health. And what's interesting here is that the Asian population moves up on this one. With reporting fair and mental health, fair and poor compared to people without disabilities. So the double burden when you combine disability and racial and ethnic minority status, people with both experience worsening health, depressive symptoms, greater diabetes, greater incidence of stroke, more visual impairment, more difficulty with activities of daily living, more obesity, more problems with physical activity, and more low workforce participation. So now I have some data, and you know, when you talk about the gaps, all this data is old. That's a gap. Nobody's looking at this right now. So in 1997, white people with Down syndrome in the U.S. had a median age of 50, and now, and African Americans was 25 and 11 years old for other races. Now I'm sure this has gone up, but I don't know how much. This is one of the big gaps, is nobody's looking at this stuff, and we just don't have the information. African Americans are diagnosed more frequently with schizophrenia and less frequently with affective disorders compared to whites who show the same exact symptoms. Asians are more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than whites, blacks, or Hispanics. And this one's scary. Only 27% of blacks receive antidepressants when first diagnosed with depression compared to 44% of whites. Older Asian American women had the highest suicide rate, 6.01 per 100,000 among older adult women of all racial ethnic groups during between 2005 and 2009. And there are many barriers to Asians seeking mental health, including stigma, lack of language access, lack of knowledge of community resources for mental illness, So it often goes unreported and untreated. Now, in 2001, and again, old data, there's a, you know, there's a research gap. The Surgeon General's report on mental health cited amazing disparities, I'll use the president's word instead of striking, in access, quality, and availability of mental health services for members of racial and ethnic minorities in the United States. And Carmen Green's research, people with chronic back pain, African Americans have prescribed fewer pain medicines than whites, and that's before the crisis, that, you know, the recent opioid crisis. African Americans and Hispanics with peripheral artery disease and diabetes experienced a greater incidence and odds of non-traumatic amputation between 1.5 and 4 times higher, and at a higher amputation rate and earlier in the process when compared with non-Hispanic whites. And the disparities in diabetes, I mean, we've all talked about this. This is nothing new, unfortunately. It's bad. but, you know, that's been a frequent topic of conversation for this group. Now, this is old data, too. I'd like to know if it's changed. The ability to do personal tasks as you age. 20% of African Americans, blacks, age 70 and older, lost the ability to perform personal tasks like eating, dressing, ADLs, compared to 17% of Latinos and 15% of whites who lost that ability. And aging and independent living, 23% of older African Americans and Hispanics were more likely than whites to have difficulty performing household tasks that help people live independently, like shopping, grocery shopping, managing money, meal preparation. So to summarize, people with disabilities experience health disparities. People who are members of racial and ethnic minorities experience health disparities. And people with disabilities who are also members of racial and ethnic minorities experience much greater health disparities. And the research gaps, I left this blank because there's so many research gaps that, you know, I could have done a whole presentation on research gaps, but I think, you know, nobody's looking at any of this. And, you know, the questions I'd like to ask are why, and is there a difference in how care is provided, access to care? I mean, just any contributor, social determinants of health, any contributor to health disparities, why is it greater at the intersection here? And I think that's something that we really need to look at and figure out why is this happening and why is nobody studying it, you know, at present.
Thank you very much, Barbara. We will entertain some questions. I will start with Liz.
Thank you, Barbara. This is an area that I have to admit that I don't think that much about, so I really appreciate this talk and looking at how there's the amplification effect in this population. Where do you think is a, you know, so some of these things are being researched, like amputations for African Americans versus whites. I'm wondering what areas are really being understudied that you would really like to see, like PCORI, focus on?
Well, I think it's being studied, but I don't think the right thing is being studied. So I think it's being studied as a problem. I don't think it's being studied as why is that necessarily, why is it happening more in African Americans than in non-African Americans, people with, you know, with diabetes. So similarly situated people with the same conditions. Why is there more amputations among African Americans than whites? So, yeah, people are studying why are these all of these amputations happening, but I don't think they're looking at the disparity piece as much. I think there are a lot of factors in disability-related factors that may be, you know, there may be implications that are specifically disability-related factors that aren't being considered. I mean, I can tell you, you know, I have a brother who had, he rolled over his toes in his wheelchair. He just got his toes amputated. You know, I know someone else who did the same thing, and they got more than that amputated. So, you know, why is that different?
Deirdre, yes.
Deidre Cruz. So I was sitting here and thinking as someone, so I do some work in aging and thinking that I know in some of my colleagues, I'm a nephrologist, so, you know, I'm studying, obviously, kidney disease among older adults. And I know some of my colleagues who do other work in kind of geriatrics and gerontology do some of this work. But I was trying to think of where does this work live in terms of generally for the few people maybe who are studying it, thinking about across if we thought about medical subspecialties or like what are the what are the groups that might, in your mind, would be more naturally drawn to this type of work? And then maybe we can think about how to outreach to those groups.
Well, I think if you're talking about, you know, some of the later stuff with functional stuff, some of the things that you would be interested in with, as people age, why are African Americans more debilitated and less, you know, have fewer independent living skills? If, you know, it's old data, but if that's still the case, I don't know that would be a medical specialty. Forgive me for being, you know, I'm an OT. I think that's an occupational therapy study. You know, to look at why is one group functioning one way and another group is functioning another way, and maybe perhaps with some other, you know, sociologists or, you know, other people on the team. But looking at function, I think it would be function. Some of the other things, I'm just not, you know, it depends on the specialty. So if you're studying, you know, kidney function, why is kidney function different in African Americans than in Caucasians, then it would be your specialty. So it doesn't have a home, and I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's one of the challenges. I think there are many challenges, but I think one of the challenges is that it does not seem to have a home. It could go across a number of different areas, but no one seems to be owning it. I think it's a challenge.
That's a good point. We'll make a comment later on that. Eleanor, please.
So I have a question. First, great presentation. I know that I hear a lot of this when I'm doing community research and the struggles that people with disabilities go through. But there's the resource through PCORI-PCORNET. Is it possible that through that channel they could do some data analytics and answer some of these questions?
Say, I think it might be, it's clearly possible to the extent that data is accurately corrected and sitting there. If the data isn't there, they can't access it. They would have to do a project to try to figure out how do we then collect that data and collect it accurately and completely in order to try to do that. To my knowledge, off the top of my head, I don't know of any one of the clinical data research centers or the patient-powered research networks that are focusing specifically on this issue. I could check on that, but off the top of my head, I don't know anyone that is in that group.
Well, I mean, I reviewed some of those when they started,
yeah.
And I think, you know, some of them have like they have to pick a disease,
yeah.
So they'll, you know, they'll have something and they'll have a lot of people, and they're,
right.
But I don't think they're studying this. So if they could pull out, you know, just off the top of my head, kidney disease and racial and ethnic, or, you know, I don't know if they have things like down to the granular level of wheelchair user or, you know, any of that stuff.
Thank you. Cincy.
Cincy Hernandez, Cancio. And first, Barbara, thank you for bringing this presentation. I've seen versions of it before, but I think it's really, you know, depressing and alarming to see these huge, huge gaps. And I think, can't remember your name, but you hit the nail on the head that it has no home, right? Like, there was a time when there weren't geriatricians, because people were not getting old. And then, you know, we improved our lifespans and the, you know, job of geriatricians had to be created. But I'm not sure that that is the right approach for this, because what we're talking about, you know, we don't want to, it's never going to happen to have just disability experts, right? And I think what we're seeing in these outcomes has a lot to do with a cumulative effect of socially determined barriers, to the extent that, you know, living in a world that doesn't accept disability in your everyday life is a socially determined barrier to begin with, and all the other race and ethnicity socially determined barriers and economic ones. So it's not like let's pick them when they're 50 and starting to have problems with their kidneys. I mean, this is an issue where we have to figure out then how do you get really primary care providers to be able to, you know, have the kind of facilities and the attitude and, you know, break the barriers they have for providing, you know, appropriate care. So the first thought that I have is that maybe we just have to start off with programs on educating providers. And I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I think that if we, and especially given the short time period that PCORI grants are, we need to bite off something discrete, and doing it so late in the game, I don't think is going to make the kind of difference that we'd be able to want to show on, you know, on paper with data. So those are just like kind of my initial thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Cindy. Umberine.
Hi, Umberine Nahal. Thank you for a great presentation. I think there's so much in that, and there's so many different kinds of populations and so many forms of intersectionality that it becomes really hard to think about what is actionable, and there must be several multiple drivers. So what is the right answer? A few comments. So one on HIPAA. HIPAA is frequently misinterpreted, and often it is attorneys on the hospital provider side who reinforce a lot of misconceptions. So to the extent that you're a part of the legal community, if there is anything you can do to speak with your colleagues on the provider side to get them to loosen up and let doctors do their job more, that would be amazing. I think part of it is that as we're thinking about value-based payment and paying only for that which is value, which is proven value, there's things that are taken out as waste that actually are needed. So oftentimes you need the provider to be actually looking a patient in the eye and building trust. And to the extent that everything is EHR driven and typing away at the computer, that's a lost opportunity. And so a lot of these patients, for instance, who have mental health issues or come from certain ethnic groups may have pre-existing trust issues with the system for a variety of reasons, including it may be that their disease itself causes them to have low trust. So it might be organic and it might be learned behavior based on bad experiences with the system. So there needs to be a way to protect the time of a provider to actually have a relationship with the patient rather than have everything be transactional and measured in terms of value. And then I can't read the rest of my handwriting, but just a few thoughts. The last thing I was going to say is that I think we saw in the glaucoma study is that I think also the categories we use often are too blunt. So, for instance, we saw that amongst Asians, there are differences within Asian population. And so I don't know the answer to that, but it's clear that minorities and those with disabilities do experience disparities, but the drivers in each of those groups may be a little bit different. And so we need to kind of be thoughtful about how we categorize people so we get at correct drivers. Thank you.
Thank you. Terry.
So being a rehabilitation nurse, first and foremost, a couple ideas come to mind. There are model systems where they have databases that could be tapped into for brain injury, spinal cord injury. The other would be the National Institute for Disability and Rehabilitation Research that I think could offer some collaboration. And there is a challenge of not one group owns this, but some that come to mind, the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine. This is the group that does research on individuals with disabilities, primarily OT, PT, physiatry, rehab nurses. And also, too, I think some of this would even encompass some of the other organizations I'm involved with American Heart. So looking at the disparities that are in the evidence, racial disparities on stroke, stroke treatment, stroke outcomes, stroke follow-up, as well as the Association of Rehab Nurses, where there have been some studies looking at disparities within women with spinal cord injury. So I think there's some opportunities where PCORI might want to reach out and target and partner and make aware of some of the funding or targeted areas where there's opportunity to encourage some thought given to these, because it is a definitely under research.
Yeah, most of this data comes from members of the disability section of the American Public Health Association. So when the Affordable Care Act was passing, I put a coalition together and we got disability in the bill. Every place where the word racial and ethnic appears, disability appears. So when we were trying to get it operationalized, we realized that nobody was in charge of it. So I said to everyone, I need data so I can go to HHS. And so people literally put data in a Dropbox, and that's how we put all this together. So, there's some stuff out there, but we need, more modern, and, yeah, those groups are all good. And NIDER, which is now NIDLR, I just reviewed grants from them a couple of weeks ago, and this would be good for PCORI to work with national, it's now called the National Institute of Disability and Independent Living Research.
And just real quickly, their chief person overseeing that is speaking at ACRM, so I know they've been doing a lot of work and collaboration on research.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And, you know, the one comment from everything you said, so nothing's happening enough that we see. And so the question, I think, for us is there a proposal that we should be thinking of? You know, and I, of course, you guys know I go to what can we actually do? And so, you know, one of the questions could be what's the impact of community health workers on decreasing amputations in people with diabetes and disability who are across different populations. It's doable. It actually crosses over health systems and to our addressing disparities group. And the target groups there are actually vascular surgeons, cardiologists, and there is already work being done in this area, so it's not as if you'd have to mint new researchers. And I do think if there are takeaways definitely from our staff of, okay, you know, we did it with the glaucoma, we came up with something, there's still that opportunity here, and something that's small, finite, doable within our time frame. And I think I'd love to see that as a takeaway from this discussion, because we should not be looking at 2019 and not saying we have not funded an additional disabilities research program. I think we can do that. So I put my support in for that. Go ahead, Cincy.
I just wanted to add to suggestions, like thinking a little bit concretely. I think, I don't know how possible this is in the PCORI framework, but the question of whether disability status is even captured, you know, so I think that can we build into future proposals just across the board to just count it? Like, are we making people count, you know, record minority status, right, whether they're racial or minority? Should we just see how much we can push adding that so that at least we start developing a database, right? The other idea is I like the idea of looking at community health worker interventions. I mean, I'm particularly partial to that. But I would try to find a project that wouldn't catch them so late in the game, right? Like, projects about how can community health worker interventions improve prevention or management before you're dealing with something as drastic as amputations or something like that. And the third piece is really the huge barrier that there is in, you know, practitioners and their willingness to be the kind of doctor that people need or provider people need, whether there are any projects that can be built around education and awareness for practitioners, and whether there are any toolboxes or best practices out there on like how to make your practice more disability friendly or something like that. I know that there was a lot of that kind of activity around cultural competence and language access for years, and I'm wondering whether that's an avenue that can be taken for this issue.
Mm-hmm. We have a group that's working, that I think they've even come up with a like model curricular stuff, but we can't get medical schools to add anything because they don't want to add anything, which is certainly understandable. And when at an IOM meeting, I suggested, well, why don't you just have a patient with a disability in the history and physicals class? And they said, we have enough trouble getting students to pass that class, to which I said, then fail them. But anyway, you know, the other thing that I think is important is that community health workers, federally qualified health centers, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there. And I know when the federally qualified health centers got building grants a couple of years ago, I reviewed those, and a lot of them were making their facilities accessible. So I think it's really necessary to, you know, follow up on that so that they understand, you know, what that means.
Thank you. Tung?
Tung Nguyen, thank you. That was really eye-opening. A couple of things. One is that because it does seem to cut across everything, I think the strategy would be to make it its own discrete category. So whether you have diabetes or whether you have stroke or you have any other diseases, anyone who has a functional impairment should be thought about as a different person to recruit. Because a lot of times, for example, if you were recruiting a study for diabetes, weight management with physical activity, you might end up excluding these people for not particularly clear reasons, right? So without specifying what those things are. The other thing, though, that I'm having trouble with is conceptually I'm still having a lot of problems. And when we were to say we want to work with disparity, I mean, with disability, you know, there's so many different categories that you listed there that just from a research point of view, not from a categorical point of view, it would be hard for me to review a grant and say, well, these are the right inclusion criteria, these are the wrong inclusion criteria, things like that. So it just, maybe I'm just not understanding the definitions.
When we passed the Affordable Care Act, we were included in data collection. And so everybody had their meeting to talk about what data would be included in all of the public health surveys. So for disability, there are six questions that are disability identifiers. And there's something like doing this off the top of my head. I don't know if it's in this. I don't know if I kept it in here. I think I took it out. Do you have trouble hearing or... do you have difficulty? Cannot hear of difficulty hearing. Can you not see or have difficulty seeing? There's a couple of those, and then there's something like, do you have trouble? This is from memory, so this isn't accurate. You know, do you have trouble running errands like going to the grocery store? There's like a functional one like that. There's a stress one. So there are six questions that basically cover everything. So those six questions could be used in the criteria.
Wow. Eleanor.
Thank you. Eleanor Schoenfeld. I want to talk about something that Sensi suggested in terms of putting it the same way as we ask race and gender and ethnicity. But the problem is that there's a wide spectrum, even beyond those questions of how you define disability, and there's also a huge stigma. So a lot of times people do not want to self-report themselves as being disabled or having a disability because of the impact and ramifications for insurance, for medical care, for even employment. So I think that getting to the heart of the matter is trying to get to some of these basic things to help us define who the population is, because it's way broader than the people who have severe disabilities. And on top of that, something else that was said, which I think is great, is to do education of the clinicians, all of the healthcare providers, how to work with, how to set up an office, how to deal with helping people with disabilities, not that there's a step at the front door or their exam table doesn't go down far enough so someone in a wheelchair could get on the exam table. But these are the kinds of things that you can work with the communities and get full engagement to figure out some answers.
Well, we now have section, I don't remember, 510, I think, of the Rehabilitation Act that has the guidelines for doctor's office and medical equipment, which would be nice if it became the standard of care, like the opioid guidelines, with a capital G for guidelines, because these are guidelines. So hopefully that might happen. The other thing is, I think the questions have been tested, and you know, it's kind of like this. My dad, who couldn't see and couldn't hear, if you asked him if he had a disability at 94, would say no. But if you said, he'd say, I'm not disabled, I just can't see and I can't hear. So I think the questions tend to get to the answers you want, because you're not putting a label on it. But I agree with everything you said about, there's a lot of stigma to saying you have a disability, but you know, getting that information is helpful.
I did promise everyone that we would be able to end at 4. I do want to thank everyone for a lot of rich discussion today. I think at our last meeting, we wanted to make sure that everyone had a chance to be heard for us to address many issues. And frankly, there have been some changes, so also wanted to make sure we took the time to explain what we see as a going forward approach. I really, as always, want to thank the staff for the great work. You guys may not be aware, but many calls occur, obviously, before this meeting, and none of us, I will speak for myself, I would not sound this coherent without the staff behind us. So really, really appreciate the work that they continue to do and know that you have our full support. I'd like to have Steve say some closing words as well to the group. We're looking forward to working with you. And we gave a lot of charges today of things we'd like to see. And one plug I'd like to make is, please let's not wait until the next meeting to talk about the communication strategy or to talk about the glaucoma issue or the asthma framework. We're all on email. It is the means of communication. We'd love to keep the conversation going. With that, thank you, everyone. Really, always an honor and privilege to be with this group. Steve.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank everyone for the warm reception to joining this panel and as part of the reorganization. I found this just a very invigorating meeting because you can imagine there are nights where it's really the challenge of trying to pull all this together is appears daunting at times, but it's nice to know that we have such support outside of our staff to really help us work through some of these issues. And you have my commitment that we are going to take advantage of your offer, both in terms of thinking about, you know, how we take advantage of, you know, this notion of trying to think about integrating these two programs in a way that really enhance the Addressing Disparities National Priority in PCORI without diminishing it in the context of everything we have to do with our program rollout. And I was really pleased that there was such an open offer to actually help us with this. And I think what we're going to do as staff, we're going to kind of go through and kind of prioritize some of those activities, probably, you know, get back with you, Cheryl, and then we'll kind of do some strategizing on ourselves and then do some outreach to people to see who's interested in trying to help us work through particularly some of these issues of definitional
everyone's issues, interested
that I think are really important for us to get ourselves on a level playing field about what we're trying to describe when we talk about concepts like equity, like integration, like, you know, these are loaded concepts that if we really have to be sure we are clear with our communication and that it's aligned with what we're trying to achieve in the programs. And it's exciting. As you see, we're starting to have results to share with you. This is, to me, is really terrific after being at PCORI for 3 years and waiting for some of this research to come out. And we look forward to that. And I think this issue of communication is really important. And I tell you, it's important to our whole program. I mean, you heard our lead area in this Evidence to Action Network of trying to pull together investigators, but we also have a major effort underway in care transitions, as well as an effort that's beginning to emerge in the area of telehealth and telemedicine, which I think is very important to addressing disparities, not only reflecting our portfolio, but the potential, particularly to reach to areas like rural, where we can talk about creating virtual systems of care. So we're real excited about that. And, again, we will be back with you and keep you informed as, you know, as things kind of go with changes in PCORI over the next several months.
Mm-hmm.